are listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
There is no crime. You can talk to Russians. What the Democrats are doing is a reverse McCarthyism that's kind of shocking. And now suddenly Donald Trump is committing impeachable offenses, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors, because he knew a few Russians. There's no proof of collusion. Collusion isn't a crime. Trump is right. This has been a witch hunt. And now what you've seen is the exposure of the deep state in a series of criminal political violations of law in order to use the justice apparatus of the United States government to make sure an opposition political candidate loses or is impeached, which is basically the definition of sedition, trying to overturn a legitimate election.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Jerome Corsi. Today's show, FISAgate. Deep State Surveillance. Jerome Corsi is an investigative journalist and was a senior staff writer for several conservative websites. He is currently Washington, D.C. correspondent for InfoWars. A prolific author, his most recent book is Killing the Deep State. For 25 years, he worked with financial institutions, insurance companies, and mutual funds, specializing in the development of third-party marketing firms, working with banks to develop retail financial planning services. Today we discuss President Trump's executive order of December 21st, 2017, Eric Schmidt's resignation from Alphabet, the Nunes memo, the FISA surveillance warrant on Carter Page, Fusion GPS, ex-British spy Christopher Steele's dossier, Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian collusion, and Corsi's analysis of QAnonymous. Today's interview is from February 12th, 2018. Dr. Jerome Corsi, welcome.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
On December 21st, 2017, President Trump signed an executive order blocking the property of persons involved in serious human rights abuse or corruption. I've heard very little about this executive order. What is this executive order about? What are its ramifications?
Well, it was an executive order that really received very little public attention. I'll pull it up here on the computer and be able to, you know, get you some more specifics on it. But it was signed, you know, with very little fanfare. It specifically blocked, it was an order blocking the property of persons involved in serious human rights abuse or corruption. It was, it gave the president the ability to instruct the Department of Treasury to confiscate the holdings of people who were involved in serious human rights abuse or corruption. And it wasn't limited to people, foreigners. It was part of the, it could be foreigners, it could be someone in the United States, et cetera. It was really out of this global Magnitsky human rights accountability law, which was a key to it. But in the process of the declaration, down in the body of it, which most people missed, not only did it say the Secretary of Treasury could confiscate the property of these people, property in terms of the United States, but it said that the president was hereby declaring a state of emergency existed over these issues. Now, that was, I think, also one of the startling parts of this. I'm going to get that exact clause right here. Just type it. Hear me typing a little bit, but here we are. It said, President Trump said, I therefore determine that serious human rights abuse and corruption around the world constitute an unusual and an extraordinary threat to national security, foreign policy, and the economy of the United States, and I hereby declare an emergency to deal with that threat. Now, the emergency is essentially that all the property and interests in the United States, or that are come to be in the United States, the people were listed in an annex to this order that the Treasury puts out, and the Treasury can add to this annex as new people are determined. The people who were initially listed were all foreigners. The Treasury can, once the president agrees that these people should be on the list, the Treasury can confiscate all their U.S. holdings. Now, I mean, that's a fairly dramatic step to be able to take, and it indicates that I think President Trump is viewing that the human trafficking and the other abuses, kidnapping of children and the like, are something he's going to deal with in this administration. And extraordinary powers, including perhaps even military powers, may be needed ultimately to deal with these kinds of issues. Now, the importance of this, I believe, in terms of working out the essentially coup d'etat that have been going on by the Democrats with, I believe, the deep state, CIA involvement, Department of Justice, FBI, to deny Trump the presidency on this Russian collusion narrative, which has so far lacked any real proof. Nobody's been indicted for it, despite months of the special counselor having investigations. So essentially, this executive order, I believe, is going to be part of the counterattack that President Trump is going to launch when probably now underway, as we see with the Nunes memo coming out, redirected attention to the corruption within the FBI and the DOJ that led to this investigation, with certain officers there clearly so anti-Trump that they were determined to take any steps they necessary to deny Trump the ability to be president. So I think we're in the middle of a beginning of essentially a great conflict in which the first attack, Mueller's attack to convict key people in the Trump administration of colluding with the Russians, has failed, and that is not going to be a charge or a narrative on which President Trump is going to be removed from office. And now we're into the second phase, which is Trump is getting ready to hit back, counterattack.
On the same day as President Trump's executive order, December 21st, 2017, Eric Schmidt announced he would be stepping down as the executive chairman of Alphabet, the holding company for Google. A lot of people are connecting these two events. Is there a connection? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think there must be some connection in the sense it happened so dramatically. I mean, of course, there could be two unrelated events, but there was no reason why Eric Schmidt should suddenly step down from Alphabet. The indications are, and as I did the research on it, and again, QAnon said that this is the intelligence source that everybody has been, increasingly trying to decide is real, not real. I've been following QAnon since about Christmas time. And I'm pretty convinced that this is a military intelligence source that is working closely with the president. And we are getting information from QAnon that we wouldn't be otherwise getting. Pointed to look at the connections between Eric Schmidt and the entire Russian narrative. Now, Eric Schmidt, first of all, was one of Hillary Clinton's main supporters. He professed that he wanted to be her chief outside advisor. We know this from the WikiLeaks emails that were published, stolen from the Democratic National Party and published, where one of them, and Eric Schmidt, is making this offer. Eric Schmidt was one of the main contributors to Hillary Clinton's campaign, both to the DNC and to the Democratic National Committee, that is, and to Hillary's campaign itself. But when it came to the Russian narrative, Russian collusion narrative, the DNC emails were taken, and then right after that, Eric Schmidt got this crowd source in to look to see what the, who did the break-in to steal the emails. That's a group that had been funded by $100 million by Eric Schmidt, and they were the first to go in and look at the DNC email theft and say it was Russians because there was this metadata that said Cozy Bear and Fuzzy Bear, which were evidently signatures of Russian hacking. What happened is that as that narrative developed, real technical analyses were done to show that the length of time in which the DNC computers had been breached and the nature of the attack, it had to have come from within. Someone basically putting in a device in a computer and downloading all of these emails, and the fingers started pointing to Seth Rich. Now, once this narrative from CrowdSource started faltering, Eric Schmidt got very interested in starting to fund through Hillary and the DNC this Fusion GPS dossier from Christopher Steele, which we heard so much about lately. And it was basically started as opposition research. First, I believe it was started funded by some Republicans who wanted to prevent Trump from getting the nomination. And it was clear Trump was going to get the nomination. It was picked up by Hillary. And again, Hillary and the DNC funded this, I'm sure, with some of the money given from Eric Schmidt, you know, that whole pool of money. And it was filtered through Perkins Coie, the attorneys, to pay Fusion GPS, an opposition research firm, who hired Christopher Steele, a British intelligence agent who formerly had been with M1 and manned the Russian desk, to put this dossier together. So Eric Schmidt's, you know, fingerprints were all over this Russian collusion narrative. Now, how that plays out, and how it did ultimately play out, you know, it seemed that Eric Schmidt also was involved in SpaceX. Clearly, Eric Schmidt, with Google and the like, has been filtering and censoring conservatives and libertarians, and has been, for his leftist views, very intolerant of others who have other views. He's been very much of a partisan. And his support of Hillary Clinton was, you know, made him a partisan without doubt. So this all comes to be, I think, that he may have said, you know, I certainly don't want my money being confiscated. And that could have been a reason. Now, that's all speculating at this point. I mean, I can't prove any of that, but it's consistent with what QAnon was suggesting was behind the scenes. And it might, in fact, explain why he did resign so quickly from Alphabet.
A House Intelligence Committee report made public on February 2nd, 2018, popularly referred to as the Nunes Memo, which you've mentioned, after the committee chair, California Republican Devin Nunes, is a four-page memo detailing the application by the FBI and the Department of Justice to obtain surveillance warrants from the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to spy on Trump campaign aide Carter Page. I understand that this surveillance warrant allowed the surveillance of everyone that Carter Page came in contact with, including Donald Trump. Bottom line is that this FISA court warrant allowed the FBI and the DOJ to wiretap pretty much everyone in the Trump campaign. In other words, the U.S. government was taking sides in the presidential election. Do you think that this is fair to say?
I think it is. I mean, just let me break down and kind of decode some of this and you know, get it into pieces that need to be understood. First of all, the Fusion GPS dossier done by Christopher Steele was ridiculous. It was outlandish. It could not be validated. It was pretty clear to anybody seriously looking at it that it had no basis in fact. Christopher Steele largely just went to whatever Russian sources and picked up whatever dirt he could, true or not. And it looks like now Sid Blumenthal, one of the notorious hatchet men that Hillary has used her entire career, also contributed information which worked its way into this Fusion GPS dossier. Now, that was one of the bases. I don't think it was necessarily the only basis, but certainly a key basis, and certainly one that the Republicans in the House Intelligence Committee have contested, that Andrew McCabe, number two in the FBI, had said was critical, without which they would not have gotten the FISA approval to do the electronic surveillance on Trump. So these FBI and DOJ officials took a document they knew to be less than trustworthy and presented it to a FISA court as the basis for getting permission to do electronic surveillance on U.S. citizens. And the whole reason the FISA court exists is because it's against the law for the NSA or the CIA to do electronic surveillance on U.S. citizens unless a citizen's involved, let's say, in a contact with a foreign national and a crime is being committed. And that's found out, and the FISA court will give limited authority to target that person. In this case, Carter Page.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Dr. Jerome Corsi. Today's show, FISAgate, Deep State Surveillance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Carter Page, it turns out, had been an undercover FBI agent and had been involved in these kinds of Russian entrapment schemes previously for the FBI. That was not disclosed. He also appears to have been a Democrat who played a role in the Clinton administration. That was not disclosed. All of this seems like Carter Page could easily have been a plant where the FBI said, why don't you go get associated with the Trump campaign, start talking about Russia, and then we'll create the Russian collusion we're trying to prove exists. So when Carter Page talked to people and emailed and telephoned them on the Trump campaign, they became collateral, the second ring of the people the FBI began monitoring. And it could have gone out from there to include others. Ultimately, you could have had, you know, dozens or more people who were under electronic surveillance under this one FISA order. And they're supposed to be masked. They're supposed to have their names, you know, the second and third levels of collateral electronic surveillance, supposed to be person A, person B, person C, so that their identities are preserved and their rights under the Fourth Amendment are not sacrificed. Just simply because they got caught up talking to somebody who was a target of a FISA court surveillance. So this information then goes over to the White House. The White House gets this information, and the White House is very interested in tracking what's happening with Trump's campaign. We know from messages exchanged between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page within the FBI that Obama wanted to know everything. So the White House gets this information from electronic surveillance, and they unmask the names. So now they identify the people on the Trump campaign who are saying these various things to Carter Page and to each other. And then that information is leaked to the press. Now, there are so many violations of law here. You know, to start with, as a officer of the court, you can't take a lying document as the basis for your asking the court for permission to do something as like a search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And then this whole plan or scheme to entrap the campaign into a Russian discussion when maybe no Russian collusion was going on until Carter Page showed up. These are all significant violations and significant problems. Now, as this all goes along, you get then to the next level of unmasking it and releasing all this information to the press, and you created further Fourth Amendment violations. So, you know, when you get down to the bottom of it, you have a deep, hardened, very politicized, weaponized Department of Justice and FBI who is determined that Donald Trump's never going to be president. And they start out on this Russian theme to, during the campaign, hopefully they want to prevent Trump from being president. That's their plan. If he should win, then they're going to use this Russian theme to either deny him being inaugurated or to get him impeached after he is inaugurated. And all of this is based on scheming, lying, breaking the rules, and for politically having a Department of Justice and FBI controlled by extreme left politicians, Obama and Clinton, who end up putting the opposition candidate for president under electronic surveillance during the campaign, during the transition, and it looks like 6 months into the presidency, they were still conducting electronic surveillance of Donald Trump and those associated with Donald Trump, which is outrageous. It sounds like a banana republic where the one party weaponizes the justice system and the federal government to look for crimes in the opposition candidate to make sure that they don't lose the election.
Let's go into how this FISA surveillance warrant was obtained. Was the evidence used to obtain the warrant fraudulent? What was the evidence presented to the FISA court, namely the Steele dossier? What did it say?
Well, I mean, it was considered to be fraudulent and scurrilous. They couldn't validate it. Comey even briefed President Trump about it and said that it was not verifiable. But yet the FBI and Department of Justice took this Fusion GPS dossier to the FISA court and made it part of their argument. We don't know how much of the argument until we see the actual petitions the Department of Justice and FBI made to the FISA court to obtain these warrants to do electronic surveillance. Those are right now classified. My guess is they're going to have to be unclassified and shown to the American public. But if that FISA GPS document was used at all, it completely compromises of the entire process of getting electronic surveillance, which in turn, if that evidence was used at all, which it was, in Mueller's special prosecutor investigations, I'd think that you could have the indictments on General Flynn and the indictments on Paul Manafort and Rick Gates thrown out of court under the Fourth Amendment doctrine of the fruit of the poisonous tree, because this information is tainting, fraudulently obtaining a FISA warrant approval to do the electronic surveillance, and then using that as part of the case development taints the whole case, even if you have other evidence.
The Washington, D.C. political opposition research firm Fusion GPS, which you've mentioned, was originally hired by a wealthy Republican donor to compile opposition research on Donald Trump and was subsequently hired by the DNC and the Clinton campaign for the same information. The company retained ex-British intelligence officer Christopher Steele, which we've been talking about, who produced a 35-page dossier. It has now been revealed that the FBI also paid for the same so-called research. Is that right?
It seems to be right so far. I mean, I think it started with a wealthy donor to maybe Jeb Bush's campaign or Rubio's campaign, looking for dirt on Trump. And they probably paid Fusion GPS and, get me dirt on Trump. And when it was clear that Trump was going to win the nomination anyway, this Fusion GPS kind of went into limbo. No, the Republican donor wasn't going to pay for it anymore. And Hillary became aware of it. And Hillary, I think, saw it as a way of reviving this Russian narrative that was flagging because CrowdSource couldn't prove definitively that the Russians had hacked the DNC. It was pretty good evidence, and Julian Assange at WikiLeaks was saying, strongly suggesting it was Seth Rich who gave him the data. And that's consistent with what the analysts looking into and understanding how computers work have analyzed with the metadata that does exist. As the way, in fact, the emails were stolen, as a leak from inside, somebody putting a device into a computer and downloading very quickly all these emails, not hacking them over a long period of time, from a distance. So, you know, when Fusion GPS starts getting paid for by the Democrats, now the Democrats own it. The Hillary and the DNC own it, and they're directing it. Well, they get it into the FBI, and the FBI said, we've been looking for something too. You know, we want to make sure Trump doesn't win or it can get impeached. And this looks kind of interesting, so we'll pay for it too. And all along, if you read the document, the claims, you know, sexual claims, which are pretty much preposterous. I mean, Putin said of this whole dossier, he said, well, I'm glad Donald Trump, he must be a highly intelligent gentleman because he understands that Russian prostitutes are the best, so he came over here to enjoy our more proficient Russian prostitutes. Made a joke of the whole thing. I mean, if Donald Trump, you know, wants prostitutes, he doesn't have to fly to Russia to get them. And that's basically what Putin was saying. And these claims, all the other claims in the dossier are equally preposterous in terms of the contacts Trump was making to do business or to, you know, Trump has had business relations in Russia for decades. But it's not a crime to have business relationships in Russia. And none of this information, even if pieces of it were partially true, did anything to suggest that Trump had a plan with Russia where Russia was going to go steal these emails and then give them to WikiLeaks so Trump would win. The reason those emails, the DNC and Podesta, were so damaging to Hillary was because of the damaging information Hillary and Podesta wrote on those emails to start with, not thinking anyone was ever going to read them. And the critical damaging part, I think, that turned Seth Rich against Hillary was that these emails made it clear that Hillary and the Democratic National Convention rigged the primaries so Hillary would win and Sanders would lose, Bernie Sanders. And that was the damaging information, not any collusion that Trump had. There's no crime, Russian collusion. That's the fundamental silliness of this entire thing. There is no crime. You can talk to Russians. What the Democrats are doing is a reverse McCarthyism that's kind of shocking, because since the revolution in Russia, it's been the left that has rushed over there to praise Stalin, despite millions of people being killed by communism, excused by the left. And now suddenly Donald Trump is committing impeachable offenses, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors, because he knew a few Russians. There's no proof of collusion. Collusion isn't a crime. Trump is right. This has been a witch hunt. And now what you've seen is the exposure of the deep state in a series of criminal political violations of law in order to use the justice apparatus of the United States government to make sure an opposition political candidate loses or is impeached, which is basically the definition of sedition, trying to overturn a legitimate election. And these people, including all the way up to Obama, I think now in the second phase where Trump's counterattack has begun, are realizing that they face serious charges here of the highest nature. And that I believe Donald Trump is putting in mechanism and putting in place what it's going to take to clean out the swamp of this deep state, including coming indictments and prosecutions against a score of people in the justice apparatus, and perhaps even in the White House, and perhaps even in the Democratic National Party. Like everyone from Barack Obama to Debbie Wasserman Schultz ought to lawyer up.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Dr. Jerome Corsi. Today's show, FISAgate, Deep State Surveillance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. The members of the FBI and the Department of Justice who signed off on the surveillance warrant and its extensions were FBI head James Comey, Andrew McCabe, who headed the FBI's investigation into the Hillary Clinton email servers, and Sally Yates, Dana Boenty, and Rod Rosenstein of the Department of Justice.
Comey was fired by Trump, and now McCabe has resigned from the FBI. This leaves the Department of Justice. If the evidence presented for the surveillance warrants was misrepresented, does this mean that the DOJ signers of the application will be resigning or fired?
Or indicted? Yes. Because these are crimes. You're not allowed, as a representative of the court, which you are as an attorney, to go in and abuse that privilege by misrepresenting critical facts to the judge. So knowing that the Fusion GPS was opposition research and not fully disclosing that, knowing that it had not been validated or verified, that the claims were outrageous and had no proven independent verification by FBI or Department of Justice research, and not making that abundantly clear to the judge, is, I think, a serious violation, especially when the consequences are that a U.S. citizen has their Fourth Amendment rights violated by being under electronic surveillance. And the web extends to those they're in collateral contact with.
Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Justice Rod Rosenstein recommended Trump fire FBI head James Comey, which Trump did. Because Attorney General Jeff Sessions had recused himself from the Russiagate investigation, this allowed Rod Rosenstein to appoint former FBI head Robert Mueller as special prosecutor to go after Trump and his team for collusion with the Russians. What has Mueller's investigation accomplished so far?
Well, Mueller's investigation so far has accomplished very little. General Flynn has been indicted for lying to the FBI, which, you know, is unfortunately easy to do when you're being interrogated and you're not used to being interrogated. If you slip or if you make one extra statement, these are the kinds of violations that they can charge you for technically. Still a felony, but it's not at the heart of Russian collusion. And Paul Manafort and Rick Gates have been indicted for what amounts to an allegation of money laundering in terms of all these kind of shell corporations that were created offshore to receive fees that they appear to have been owed for work they did in the Ukraine. Again, this is not related to Russian collusion for the election. There may have been some criminal violations there, but they had never been detected by the IRS. They had never been found to be objectionable until Mueller began his special prosecutor investigation. And the indictment has nothing to do with Russian collusion. So far, Mueller's been a total flop. And it would appear to be that it would appear to me to be a flop because, again, as I say, there isn't a crime Russian collusion. And that there's no evidence that it would be meaningful. I mean, the idea that Trump colluded with Russia to get these emails is, you know, first of all, the Donald Trump campaign was not a very organized campaign to begin with. It was small. It was, you know, like many campaigns, chaotic. I don't think they could have colluded among themselves to do anything. That was part of the problem. They had three campaign managers. They had to continually work and struggle to keep the campaign on message. Yeah, the campaign, looked at from a certain perspective, was a train wreck. They weren't colluding with anybody. And the idea that they had a sophisticated plan with Russian operatives to steal the Democratic Party's emails, knowing that they would be detrimental to Hillary. I mean, how would anybody know those emails wouldn't have just glorified Hillary if Podesta and Hillary hadn't written such trash about each other and everybody else in the Democratic Party? Those emails would not have been damaging to be revealed. Trump didn't write those emails. He didn't know what was in them. He had no reason to go after them. The whole thing is preposterous. And the idea that we want to criminalize dealing with Russians coming from the Democratic Party after anyone who lived through the 1950s is so preposterous, you think the Democratic Party's lost its mind. The Democratic Party's always been about embracing the left, progressivism, and had about in 1917 gushed over the Russian Revolution until, of course, Stalin killed 30 or 40 million people.
And do you think that there's an inherent contradiction for Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to suggest to Trump to fire Comey and then turn around and hire Robert Mueller as a special prosecutor to go after Trump for Russian collusion?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is pretty preposterous. First of all, Mueller gets presented as if he's, you know, Mr. Clean.
Yeah.
Rosenstein goes back to having participated as an attorney on the Whitewater investigation. No charges were filed, even though now from the files, we see again it was a political fix because the Department of Justice and the FBI believe there were crimes. They were already writing an indictment until they were blocked. Mueller played a role. I think the real vulnerability of Mueller is the Uranium One deal, because that was a huge scandal, still is, with Hillary Clinton receiving, as Peter Schweitzer points out, up to maybe $147 million in the Clinton Foundation. Charles Ortel has done good work on it. I wrote a chapter in my book, Partners in Crime, on the Uranium One scandal, pay to play. For the Clintons, ultimately, with this entrepreneur in Canada, Frank Giustra, getting the uranium rights in Kazakhstan, and then the United States, Russia comes in, wants to buy Uranium One. The CFIUS committee rubber stamps it, which is the committee created by Treasury to look at foreign investments in the United States. And Robert Mueller is running an investigation, the FBI, when the FBI knows there's a massive bribery scandal where the Russians are trying to bribe people in the uranium industry, and he doesn't let that information go to the CFIUS committee members, which, if they'd known it, would have been probably very reluctant to let Russia take over Uranium One with Rosatom. Mueller also played a major cover-up role, I believe, in the HSBC money laundering case. Along with Loretta Lynch, I helped uncover that case when a branch manager from HSBC in Long Island brought me about 1,000 pages and showed me how the money was being laundered through accounts in those branches out in Long Island. I wrote about it, worked with the Permanent Senate Investigating Committee and with the Department of Homeland Security. Loretta Lynch gave HSBC, with Robert Mueller, you know, heading the FBI, a $1.9 billion fine, which was about, you know, cost of business fine, didn't really hurt HSBC, no criminal prosecutions. And what Mueller, Loretta Lynch, and Obama are covering up was the fact that the, you know, CIA is deeply involved in the drug trade, and that it was known that the money was being laundered. You can't launder billions of dollars through a bank like HSBC and not have it be observed by one of the regulators who's supposed to be, you know, watchdogging these banks, controller of the currency, the, you know, the bank, various bank regulators, the Department of Justice, all of the massive terrorist and drug money laundering. I don't think so. So Mueller ought to come back and answer some questions on that. And I think the Uranium One has the potential to put Mueller under investigation himself. And the moment that happens, I think he'll have to resign.
Robert Mueller was sworn in as director of the FBI 7 days before September 11th, 2001, not resigning until 2014. Mueller headed up the FBI during and after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. How would you evaluate Mueller's performance as FBI head? And what do we know about Robert Mueller?
What we know about Robert Mueller is that everywhere back to the Mark Rich Pardon, he's been a Clinton cover-up deep state artist. And he's done the dirty work for the deep state to, you know, bury and end investigations and lie over any number of investigations, including 9/11. You know, we get bits and pieces that come out that should have been investigated. What are all these Saudis doing with the Bushes getting flown out of the country? Michael Moore was right about that. What about these buildings falling down that weren't part of the initial plane attack? Why did these buildings fall down? You know, what the entire launching into a war on terror depends on the official explanation of 9/11 not being challenged. And anybody who does challenge it being considered, again, a conspiracy theorist nut. And it goes on and on from there with a list of investigations and issues that Mueller, I believe, could have brought forward, should have brought forward, and basically chose to go along with the deep state and cover up. The FBI under Obama, especially, but Clinton, even to some extent Trump, Bush did nothing to clean it up. But under Obama, there was a heavy overdrive to make the FBI and the DOJ a politically charged, weaponized group that went after you if you were conservative or libertarian and gave you a pass. Hillary Clinton could run a foundation that was, you know, a disgrace, crooked, a criminal enterprise. The accounting is terrible. Charles Ortel has done brilliant work on that. Peter Schweitzer, I've tried to bring it to the public's attention that this is not a charity. It's a disgrace. It's a criminal operation. All the filings are wrong. Firms, including Price Waterhouse, who did their accounting of criminal, I believe, liabilities, if someone would only legitimately investigate it. The emails, we know there was, you know, all of these things were covered up and continue to be covered up within an FBI and DOJ that serves Democrats and get away with anything.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Dr. Jerome Corsi. Today's show, FISAgate, Deep State Surveillance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. When Hillary Clinton gave her concession speech the morning after the presidential election, both she and Bill Clinton were wearing matching colors of deep purple. It looked very obvious that they were announcing a color revolution here in the U.S. against President-elect Donald Trump. Both the Clintons and the Bushes are publicly opposed to the presidency of Donald Trump. The FBI and the Department of Justice have played significant roles in the attempt to take down the president, which you've been discussing. Has the CIA played a role in what we might call this attempted coup d'etat?
I think the CIA is probably the major culprit in many ways. I mean, the CIA, I think, has penetrated the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Obama White House, the IRS. I think in the State Department, while the CIA is building its own massive surveillance system with these computers they call Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, which are rivals to the NSA. The CIA goes into a war wanting to put the NSA out of business. And the whole thing is rotten to the core. I mean, Jack Kennedy was right when he said he should have broken up the CIA into 1,000 pieces after it lied to him both on the Bay of Pigs and on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy's mistake is he didn't do it that day. And, you know, the CIA has been a nefarious, secretive arm of our government, which has been running drugs of the drug war since before the CIA was created in the precedent organization, the OSS. And I can recommend you a dozen good books on that subject, including Doug Valentine's excellent work, which documents it. Plus, you know, dozens of other books and committee hearings, which validate it. Going back to the Church Committee, the CIA's intrusion into massive electronic surveillance of the population was made abundantly clear. And none of the reforms have done anything to stop the CIA. CIA has been wildly out of control. And I believe now has reached the point where, unfortunately, it's become a criminal organization.
A lot of people voted for Trump because they were against the foreign wars, the 9/11 wars, and Hillary Clinton was clearly the war candidate, calling Vladimir Putin Hitler, etc. Trump wanted good relations with Russia, for instance. Is the Trump presidency in jeopardy of being overtaken by Zionist neocons who want endless war? What is your assessment?
I think Trump is much more in line with an ambassador named Matlock, who professed for decades the need to talk with Russia and to China, that these were going to be three major states. Each was going to have its sphere of influence. We really, truly weren't going to go to a thermonuclear war over some Eastern European country that Americans basically don't know how to say or spell the name correctly. And each of these three superpowers are going to have to contend with the other two. And that's only going to be done in conversation. One of the things that Jack Kennedy learned in the Cuban Missile Crisis was that the military and the CIA, represented by people like Curtis LeMay, wanted war, wanted even thermonuclear war, thought they could win it. Kennedy's listening to it. The tapes are available. Go listen to them in the National Archives. I've listened to a lot of them, and it's shocking the extent to which the military wants to go to war. Kennedy finally figured out, he bypassed the military and the CIA, and he started communicating with Khrushchev directly over this, you know, special teletype system they had in place in 1962. And when Kennedy came out of it, he gave a speech at the American University, which maybe was his best speech of his entire presidency, in which he said the Russians are like us. They want to grow old and die in their beds surrounded by their families. So that we don't really have any need or any reason to go to a thermonuclear war with Russia. We don't need massive numbers of nuclear weapons. Kennedy began pursuing nuclear disarmament and began reducing the numbers of weapons in place and dealing directly with Khrushchev. I think these were part of the element. Kennedy saw did not want globalism, did not want central bankers. He was printing his own money through the Treasury, understood the Rothschilds, and you know, the central bankers were happy to throw the world into World War I and World War II while they made the money on the munitions and the interest financing the munitions. All these globalist schemes, I think, with Trump, Brexit, the New World Order, the European Union, you know, the North America trade going into a North American Union, the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America that George Bush professed. I think Americans are seeing through all of this, and the world hopefully will, to reject this globalist, basically evil idea of the future and get back to what the Constitution was about, was that we the people are sovereign, and we don't need these globalists and central bankers to tell us how to live.
What can you tell us generally about the phenomenon of Q or QAnon? What is QAnon?
Well, it's Q Anonymous, and the Anonymous are on the deep bulletin board part of the internet called the Chan, C-H-A-N. 8chan is a very difficult to navigate bulletin board and a very kind of robust atmosphere where people are sharp with each other, and it's very brilliant researchers are on this, as well as people who are trolling it. And it's an aggressively, hotly debated environment and produced some very interesting information. It's very much like the first American Revolution. The pamphleteers, you know, Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, not using his own name. And these were widely read and upped the awareness, the American people, of the oppression of Great Britain that led ultimately to the Revolutionary War. So, two, you've got today Q, which is one of the highest levels of intelligence, is Q level clearance. Began posting in October, and I watched it pretty much from a distance. Around December, some of very serious people began inviting me, saying, "You really need to pay attention to this. We want you to do this." And as I got into it, I began to realize that what Q was saying and how he said it really sounded a lot like military intelligence. And I've got a pretty good idea who's organized the Q posts. But the information that is being given has two characteristics of it, which are very important. It's not always 100% right, but then intelligence is not always 100% right. But it has the ability to disclose in advance events that are going to happen later. The most recent example that I can think of was that about 3 weeks before the Nunes memo was released, and it was a highly classified document until it was declassified by the president, the Q said this memo is going to show the Fusion GPS was used as the basis to obtain the FISA court approvals of electronic surveillance of Donald Trump's political campaign. And that turned out to be the core of what the document was about. And then Q said it will be game changing. This will be, the narrative is going to shift as soon as this is published. Now that was done a week ago, was dropped publicly, the Nunes memo, a week ago Friday. And the narrative has dramatically shifted to a focus on improprieties within the Department of Justice and the FBI in pursuing this vengeance campaign to make sure Donald Trump never got elected, or if he did get elected, that he got impeached, which the FBI and the DOJ are not empowered by law to make that kind of a judgment and act upon it. There's not supposed to be political organizations. And what we've found since the Nunes memo has been dropped, including from Senator Grassley's Judiciary Committee and others, we are finding through Congress shocking revelations on the way the Democratic National Committee, the Obama administration at the highest levels, including the president, politicized DOJ and weaponized it and the FBI. And this is going to have massive ramifications. So Q saw that in advance, telegraphed it, and then was able to analyze it as it was proceeding in a way that forced everybody following Q to make connections and associations in advance of them becoming public. And that's basically what good intelligence does. I mean, I had top secret clearance in the 80s when I worked with university programs with the State Department on anti-terrorism. And good intelligence has these characteristics of being able to lead higher level thinking to formulate decisions that need to be made. I'd say Q is similar to the multiple sources that were deep throat for the Watergate investigation. And there was not one deep throat. That was a movie invention. There were several. And the Q source today is like a public version. You can find it, read it, track it. I'm writing about it on my Twitter account and on my YouTube account. Both have a lot of information. Jerome.Corsi in Twitter and JRLCORSI is my initials, JRLCORSI for YouTube. But the point is, this is, I think, the most extensive sharing of military intelligence, not tactical military intelligence, but political military intelligence done by someone trained in how the military does intelligence, which is different than the way the CIA does intelligence, different from the way the State Department does intelligence. And with experience, you can begin to distinguish them and pretty reliably figure out where the intelligence is coming from. And I think it's proving to be highly both provocative and reliable, and it's getting to be followed by millions of people.
Well, now the Q posts are written in code, aren't they? I mean, they're not easily decipherable.
Well, I've been decoding them. You have to think about them. Good intelligence is often, when you're reading it, it looks a lot like code. It is putting pieces together. Now, if you understand the references, the code is fairly transparent. pretty easy to read. But if you're new at it and don't understand the references, it looks like it's, you know, some kind of a puzzle. You have to, you know, work to decipher. There's some cryptic elements to it, but once you get the patterns down and know the references and what they mean, then the deciphering it is a lot easier. I've been spending time as the Q posts come out working with this group of Anonymous. They created what they call the Calm Before the Storm. It's on Twitter. They're at CBTS_stream. It has been 24-hour coverage of the QAnon on YouTube with this CBTS_stream live chat that gets participated in by maybe up to 8,000 or 10,000 people when there are new Q posts to evaluate.
And if somebody wants to follow Q, how would they do it?
Well, I'd say I've always linked, continue to link both on my Twitter account and on YouTube too. There's one or two sites that list all of Q's posts. Then there's various interpretations, I think, which are extremely worthwhile following. My Twitter account, I try to keep up with it on a continuing basis. That's Jerome.Corsi. My YouTube, JRLCORSI, that's my channel. I'm posting long decodes. Some of those discussions are from the CBTS, the Calm Before the Storm _stream board. And you can really hear the discussions. I mean, some of those posts I'm doing are an hour long.
Dr. Jerome Corsi, thank you.
My pleasure.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Jerome Corsi. Today's show has been FISAgate, Deep State Surveillance. Today's interview was from February 12, 2018. Jerome Corsi is an investigative journalist and was a senior staff writer for several conservative websites. He graduated magna cum laude in political science and economics from Case Western and received his doctorate in political science from Harvard University. His latest book is Killing the Deep State. He is currently the Washington, D.C. correspondent for InfoWars. Follow him on Twitter at Jerome.Corsi. That's JEROME.CORSI. His YouTube channel is JRL Corsi. That's JRL Corsi. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the Trump administration is a dumpster fire, but let's not get too nostalgic for Barack Obama. Noam Chomsky discusses why in a talk he gave just before Obama was inaugurated. I hope you'll stay tuned. Every day now, there's a new outrage coming from the White House. And every day, more Americans conclude that Donald Trump is not fit to be president. They're right, but that's not the important story. Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush were every bit as vulgar and moronic as Donald Trump. And by 2007, Bush was every bit as unpopular as Trump. There are two differences between then and now. First, Reagan and Bush were better politicians than Trump. Secondly, Reagan and Bush spent their lives, including their presidencies, effectively serving America's ruling class, making sure that the corporate and financial elite got everything they wanted. Deregulation, privatization, less environmental protection, crackdowns on democracy, tax cuts for the rich, decreased services for the poor, no national health care, and war, war, and more war. To date, Trump has done nothing any more vile and reprehensible than a dozen different abominations perpetrated by his two Republican predecessors. Let us not forget St. Ronald Reagan's detestable, racist, repeated lies about an epidemic of welfare queens, presumably black, driving Cadillacs and using their food stamps to buy hard liquor. But the elite so liked the goodies that Reagan and Bush were delivering that they had the mass media that they owned grant each of them a platinum-level, lifetime, get-out-of-jail-free card. Trump never got the card. And the right-wing Republicans, now controlling both houses of Congress, are hard at work turning America into a dictatorship of the oligarchs. We should be grateful for Trump's incompetence, as Trump is interfering with the program almost as much as he is advancing it. But let us not lapse into nostalgia for Democrat Barack Obama. By every measure, Obama is a wiser, more cultured, more humane human being than Donald Trump, and a better politician. But like all of his predecessors, Obama too served the oligarchs at the expense of the 99%. You recall that he devoted the first 2 years of his presidency addressing the financial collapse and economic depression brought about by the financial industry's fraud and wild speculation. He addressed these problems by giving over $1 trillion in your taxes to the rich investors of these criminal Wall Street firms, so no big investor would lose a penny from the corporate crimes and economic collapse that they caused. In exchange for the trillion, we got nothing in return, and Obama did almost nothing for the millions of ordinary Americans who lost their jobs and had their houses repossessed, often illegally. As Noam Chomsky noted back in 2008, all of Obama's announced top appointments were the same financial industry CEOs and the same military-industrial complex war hawks whom Obama had pretended to be opposing during his presidential campaign. Chomsky also contrasted the mostly fake managed elections in the U.S., all controlled by the PR industry, with the genuinely democratic elections in two third-world countries. Here, the common people chose a candidate who actually represented their interests and swept him into power. This was Bertrand Aristide of Haiti and Evo Morales of Bolivia. Chomsky gave this talk 10 years ago in Boston. He spoke November 19, just 2 weeks after the 2008 presidential elections. He argued that America's then celebration of the democratic process was premature at best. He predicted that the election of Obama was not a sign of any fundamental change to come. 10 years later, I am sorry to say that Chomsky was right on every count. From November 2008, with words for our own time, here is Noam Chomsky.
Well, let's begin with the elections. The word that rolls off everyone's tongue is historic. Historic election. And I agree with it. It was a historic election. To have a black family in the White House is a momentous achievement. In fact, it's historic in a broader sense. The two Democratic candidates were an African-American and a woman, both remarkable achievements. If you go back, say, 40 years, it would have been unthinkable. So something's happened to the country in 40 years. What's happened to the country, which is we're not supposed to mention, is that there was extensive and very constructive activism in the 1960s, which had an aftermath. So the feminist movement mostly developed in the 70s, the solidarity movements in the 80s, and on till today. And the activism did civilize the country. It's an important achievement. The country's a lot more civilized than it was 40 years ago, and the historic achievements illustrate it. And that's also a lesson for what's next. What's next will depend on whether the same thing happens. Changes and progress very rarely are gifts from above. They come out of struggles from below. The answer to what's next depends on people like you. Nobody else can answer it. It's not predictable. The election was surprising in some respects, going back to my bad prediction. If the financial crisis hadn't taken place at the moment that it did, if it had been delayed a couple of months, I suspect that prediction would have been correct. But not speculating, one thing surprising about the election is that it wasn't a landslide. By the usual criteria, you'd expect the opposition party to win in a landslide under conditions like the ones that exist today. The incumbent president for 8 years was so unpopular that his own party couldn't mention his name and had to pretend to be opposing his policies. He's presided over maybe the worst record for ordinary people in post-war history, in terms of job growth, real wealth, and so on. Just about everything the administration has touched has turned into a disaster. Countries reached the lowest level of standing in the world that it's ever had. And the economy was tanking. Several recessions are going on, not just the one on the front pages, the financial recession, but there's also a recession in the real economy, the productive economy. And people know it. So 80% of the population say the country's going in the wrong direction. About 80% say government does not work for the benefit of the people. It works for the few and the special interests. Startling 94% complain that the government doesn't pay any attention to the public will, and on like that. Under conditions like that, you'd expect a landslide for the opposition, almost whoever they are. And there wasn't one, which does raise some questions. So one might ask why there wasn't a landslide. In other respects, the outcome was pretty familiar. Once again, the election was essentially bought. 9 out of 10 of the victors outspent their opponents. Obama, of course, outspent McCain. We don't have final records yet from the final results, but they're probably going to be pretty much like the preliminary results a couple of months ago, which showed that both Obama and McCain were getting the bulk of their financing from the financial institutions, and for Obama, law firms, which means essentially lobbyists. Over a third, a few months ago, probably final results will probably be the same. The distribution of funding has over time been a pretty good predictor of what policies will be like. For those of you who are interested, there's very good scholarly work on this by Tom Ferguson at UMass Boston, what he calls the investment theory of politics, which argues essentially that elections are moments when groups of investors coalesce and invest to control the state, and has quite substantial predictive success, gives some suggestion as to what's likely to happen. So that part's familiar. What the future is, as I say, depends on people like you. The response to the election was interesting and instructive. It kept pretty much to the soaring rhetoric, to borrow the cliche that was the major theme of the election. The election was described as an extraordinary display of democracy, a miracle that could only happen in America, and on, much more extreme in Europe even than here. There's some accuracy in that, if we keep to the West. So if we keep to the West, yes, it's probably true that it couldn't have happened anywhere else. Europe is much more racist than the United States and wouldn't expect anything like that to happen. On the other hand, if we look at the world, it's not that remarkable. Let's take, say, the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti and Bolivia. In Haiti, there was an election in 1990, which really was an extraordinary display of democracy, much more so than this. In Haiti, there were popular movements that developed in the slums and in the hills, which nobody was paying any attention to. And they managed, even without any resources, to sweep into power their own candidate, a populist priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. That's a victory for democracy, when popular movements can organize and set programs and pick their candidate and put him into office, which is not what happened here, of course. I mean, Obama did organize a large number of people and many enthusiastic people, what's called in the press Obama's army. But the army is supposed to take instructions, not to introduce, develop programs and call on its own candidate to implement them. That's critical. If the army keeps to that condition, nothing much will change. If it, on the other hand, goes the way activists did in the 60s, a lot could change. One of the choices that has to be made. So that's Haiti. Of course, that didn't last very long. A couple of months later, there was a military coup, period of terror. Up to the present, the traditional torturers of Haiti, France, and the United States have made sure that there won't be a victory for democracy there. It's a miserable story, contrary to many illusions. Take the second poorest country, Bolivia. They had an election in 2005 that's almost unimaginable in the West, certainly here, anywhere. The person elected into office was indigenous. That's the most oppressed population in the hemisphere, that is, those who survived. He's a poor peasant. How did he get in? He got in because there were, again, mass popular movements which elected their own representative. And they are the source of the programs, which are serious ones. They're real issues, and people know them. Control over resources, cultural rights, social justice, and so on. Furthermore, the election was just an event that was a particular stage in a long continuing struggle, a lot before and a lot after. There was a day when people pushed the levers, but that's just an event in ongoing popular struggles. Very serious ones. A couple of years ago, there was a major struggle over privatization of water, effort to, which would in effect deprive a good part of the population of water to drink. And it was a bitter struggle. A lot of people were killed, but they won it through international solidarity, in fact, which helped. And it continues. Now, that's a real election. Again, the plans, the programs being developed, acted on, constantly by mass popular movements, which then select their own representative from their own ranks to carry out their programs. And that's quite different from what happened here. Actually, what happened here is understood by elite elements. The public relations industry, which runs elections here, quadrennial extravaganzas, essentially, make sure to keep issues in the margins and focus on personalities, character, and so on and so forth. They do that for good reasons. They look at public opinion studies, and they know perfectly well that on a host of major issues, both parties are well to the right of the population. That's one good reason to keep issues off the table. And they recognize the success. So every year, the advertising industry gives a prize to the best marketing campaign of the year. This year, Obama won the prize, beat out Apple Company, the best marketing campaign of 2008. Which is correct. You know, that's essentially what happened. Now, that's quite different from what happens in a functioning democracy, like, say, Bolivia or Haiti, except for the fact that it was crushed. And in the South, it's not all that uncommon. Notice that each of these cases is a much more extraordinary display of democracy in action than what we've seen, important as it was here. So the rhetoric, especially in Europe, is correct if we maintain our own narrow racist perspectives and say, yeah, what happens in the South didn't happen or it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is what we do, and by our standards, it was extraordinary, miracle, but not by the standards of functioning democracy. In fact, there's a distinction in democratic theory which does separate, say, the United States from Bolivia or Haiti. The question is, what is a democracy supposed to be? That's actually a debate that goes back to the Constitutional Convention. But in recent years, say in the 20th century, it's been pretty well articulated by important figures. So at the liberal end, progressive end, the leading public intellectual of the 20th century was Walter Lippmann, Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, progressive. A lot of his work was on a democratic theory, and he was pretty frank about it. He took a position not all that different from James Madison's. He said that in a democracy, the population has a function. Its function is to be spectators, not participants. He didn't call it the population. He called it the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. The ignorant and meddlesome outsiders have a function, namely to watch what's going on. And to push a lever every once in a while, then go home. But the participants are us privileged, smart guys. Well, that's one conception of democracy, and yeah, that's essentially, we've seen an episode of it. The population very often doesn't accept this. As I mentioned in just very recent polls, people overwhelmingly oppose it. But they're atomized, separated, many of them feel hopeless, unorganized, and don't feel they can do anything about it. So they dislike it, but that's where it ends. In a functioning democracy, like, say, Bolivia or the United States in earlier stages, they did something about it. That's why we have the New Deal measures, the Great Society measures. In fact, just about any step, women's rights, end of slavery, go back as far as you like. It doesn't happen as a gift, and it's not going to happen in the future. The commentators are pretty well aware of this. Although they don't put it the way I'm going to, but if you read the press, it does come out. So take our local newspaper at the liberal end of the spectrum, the Boston Globe. You probably saw right after the election a front page story. The lead front page story was on how Obama developed this wonderful grassroots army, but he doesn't have any debts, which is supposed to be a good thing. So he's free to do what he likes. Because he has no debts, the normal Democratic constituencies, labor, women, minorities, and so on, they didn't bring him into office. So he owes them nothing. What he had was an army that he organized of people who got out the vote for Obama, for what the press calls Brand Obama. They essentially agree with the advertisers. It's Brand Obama that his army was mobilized to bring into office. They regard that as a good thing, accepting the Lippmann conception of democracy. The ignorant and meddlesome outsiders are supposed to do what they're told and then go home. The Wall Street Journal, at the opposite end of the spectrum, also had an article about the same thing, roughly the same time. It talked about this tremendous grassroots army that had been developed, which is now waiting for instructions. So what should they do next to press forward Obama's agenda, whatever that is. But whatever it is, the army is supposed to be out there taking instructions and press forward. Los Angeles Times had similar articles, and there are others. What they don't seem to realize is that what they're describing, the ideal that they're describing, is dictatorship, not democracy. Democracy, at least not in the Lippmann sense, the approved, I pick him out because he's so famous, but it's a standard position. But in the sense of, say, much of the South, where mass popular movements develop programs, organize to take part in elections, but that's one part of an ongoing process, and bring somebody from their own ranks to implement the programs that they develop. And if the person doesn't, they're out. Okay, that's another kind of democracy. So it's up to us to choose which kind of democracy we want, and again, that'll determine what comes next. Well, what can we anticipate if the popular army, the grassroots army, decides to accept the function of spectators of action rather than participants? There's two kinds of evidence. There's rhetoric and there's action. The rhetoric, we know, it's very uplifting. Change, hope, and so on. Change was kind of reflexive. Any party manager this year who read the polls, including the ones I cited, would instantly conclude that our theme in the election has to be change, because people hate what's going on for good reasons. So the theme is change. And in fact, both parties, for both of them, the theme was change, you know, break from the past, none of the old politics, new things are going to happen. The Obama campaign did it better, so they won the marketing award, not the McCain campaign. And notice, incidentally, on the side, that the institutions that run the elections, the public relations industry, advertisers, their major role is commercial advertising. Selling a candidate is a kind of a side role. In commercial advertising, as everybody knows, everybody who's ever, say, looked at a television program, the advertising is not intended to provide information about the product, right? I don't have to go on about that. It's obvious. The point of the advertising is to delude people with imagery and tales of a football player or a sexy actress who, you know, drives to the moon in a car or something like that. But it's certainly not to inform people. In fact, it's to keep people uninformed. The goal of advertising is to create uninformed consumers who will make irrational choices. Those of you who've suffered through an economics course know that markets are supposed to be based on informed consumers making rational choices. But industry spends hundreds of millions of dollars a year to undermine markets and to ensure that you get uninformed consumers making irrational choices. And when they turn to selling a candidate, they do the same thing. They want uninformed consumers, voters, to make irrational choices based on the success of illusion, slander, invective, body language, or whatever else is supposed to be significant. So you undermine democracy pretty much the same way you undermine markets. That's the nature of an election when it's run by the business world, and you'd expect it to be like that. There should be no surprise there. And it should also turn out that the elected candidate doesn't have any debts. So you can follow brand Obama, can be whatever they decide it to be, not what the population decides that it should be, as in the South, let's say. I might say on the side that this may be an actual instance of the familiar and usually vacuous slogan about clash of civilizations. And maybe there really is one, but not the kind that is usually touted. So let's go back to the evidence that we have, rhetoric and actions. Rhetoric, we know. Now, what are the actions? Well, so far, the major actions are selection of, in fact, the only actions are selection of personnel to implement brand Obama. The first choice was the vice president, Joe Biden, one of the strongest supporters of the war in Iraq in the Senate. Longtime Washington insider, you know, rarely deviates from the party vote. The cases where he does deviate are not very uplifting. So he did break from the party in voting for a Senate resolution that prevented people from getting rid of their debts by individuals, that is, from getting rid of their debts by going into bankruptcy. It's a blow against poor people who are caught in this immense debt that's a large part of the basis for the economy these days. But usually he's a kind of straight party liner, votes with the Democrats on the sort of ultra-nationalist side. The choice of Biden must have been a conscious attempt to show contempt for the base of people who were voting for Obama and were organizing for him as an anti-war candidate. Well, the first post-election appointment was for chief of staff, which is a crucial appointment, determines a large part of the president's agenda. That was Rahm Emanuel, one of the strongest supporters of the war in Iraq in the House. In fact, he was the only member of the Illinois delegation who voted for Bush's effective declaration of war. And again, a longtime Washington insider. Also one of the leading recipients in Congress of funding from the financial institutions and hedge funds and so on. He himself was an investment banker. So that's the chief of staff. The next group of appointments were the main problem, the primary issue that the government's going to have to face is what to do about the financial crisis. The Obama's choices to more or less run this were Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, Secretaries of Treasury under Clinton. They are among the people who are substantially responsible for the crisis. Actually, one leading economist, one of the few economists who's been right all along in predicting what's happening, Dean Baker, pointed out that selecting them is like selecting Osama bin Laden to run the war on terror. There was a meeting on November 7th, I think, of a group of a couple of dozen advisors to deal with the financial crisis. Their careers were, records were reviewed in the business press. Bloomberg News had an article reviewing their records and concluded that most of these people shouldn't be giving advice about the economy. They should be getting subpoenas because they were, most of them were involved in, were involved in one or another form of financial fraud. That includes Rahm Emanuel, for example. He said, you know, what reason is there to think that the people who brought this crisis about are somehow going to fix it? Well, that's a good indication of what's likely to come next, at least if we look at actions. We could, but I won't, you can bring this up, ask what we expect to see in particular cases. And there's evidence about that from statements from Obama's website. I'll mention just one thing about Obama's website, which gives an indication of what's happening. One of the major problems coming is Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's pretty serious. Take a look at Obama's website under issues, foreign policy issues. The names don't even appear. We're supposed to be ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. We're not supposed to know what brand Obama is. So you can't find out that way. The statements that you hear are pretty hawkish. And it doesn't change much as you go through the list, but I'll wrap up here. So it's up to you to continue.
Noam Chomsky, speaking in Boston, November 19, 2008. I am Kenneth Doust, speaking in Hartford or thereabouts. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, look for newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum. Remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things. And please tune in again next week. Peace.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, we're going to be focusing on false flag terrorism. So first, you're going to hear a recent article by 9/11 researcher Kevin Ryan, and then that'll be followed by an audio clip about false flag terrorism. So let's begin with the article. This came out on January 28th, 2018, by Kevin Ryan, and it's called The Terrorism Lottery. And you can find this article on globalresearch.ca or on Kevin Ryan's own personal website called digwithin.net. So here goes. In 1948, The New Yorker published what would become one of the most famous short stories in American literature. This was The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, which told the tale of a community that once every year selected a citizen to be stoned to death in order to ensure a good harvest. Jackson was flooded with hate mail after her story was published. Some readers thought the story represented a real situation, and others were offended that anyone could imagine such a scenario. Although the story was meant to depict only the idea of mindless violence and apathy in human society in the 21st century, it has become a reflection of the general attitude toward terrorism. Consider the crimes of 9/11. As in The Lottery, on a bright summer day, people were selected to die by means of their presence at the World Trade Center, at the Pentagon, and on the hijacked flights. They weren't stoned to death, but they were killed by willful ignorance. That's because much of the public never wanted to know the truth about previous terrorist incidents and simply accepted dubious government accounts. For example, neither the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing nor the tragedy of the USS Cole in October of 2000 have been examined closely by most people. The mindless acceptance of the official account for these events led to the crimes of 9/11, after which the indifference to facts was taken to the next level. What facts were ignored after 9/11? The list would be endless, but here are a few examples. Number one, insider trading related to 9/11 was ignored, and the suspects were not even questioned by the FBI or the 9/11 Commission. Number two, the third skyscraper that fell that day in an obvious demolition event, which was World Trade Center Building 7, was simply not mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. Number three, eyewitness testimony was hidden from the public for years and later ignored. This included the testimony of firefighters who said that explosives were going off throughout the World Trade Center towers. Number four, building construction codes were not changed as a result of the root causes cited by the government for the destruction of the World Trade Center. Number five, everyone agrees that the public was lied to about the failure of the National Air Defense that day. The question avoided is whether to believe the government's story that the U.S. military lied repeatedly for years to make itself look bad, or the much simpler explanation that the 9/11 Commission lied in its final report to divert attention away from the whole matter. Number six, the government reports on the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings ignored basic laws of science and would have failed peer review. Meanwhile, the only actual peer-reviewed science on the subject, for example, went unheeded. By ignoring the facts related to 9/11, the public has prepared itself to be terrorized on a regular basis. Recurring acts of terrorism follow a formula that is transparent to anyone who cares to examine the evidence beyond simply accepting corporate media reports. An outstanding example is the San Bernardino shooting in December 2015. The Los Angeles Times reported that a year after the San Bernardino shooting, federal officials acknowledge they still don't have answers to some of the critical questions. San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Burguan said, "We never established the motive. The best we can do is theorize." This was a mass shooting in which most of the evidence was ignored in favor of an official account that accused a brown-skinned Muslim husband and his wife. Contrary to the unchallenged accusation, the evidence suggests that the attackers were three white men who appeared to be special operations soldiers. At the time of the attack, a Los Angeles television station stated, quote, police looking for three white males dressed in military gear, unquote. The only eyewitness to the shootings said the perpetrators were three tall, athletic white men in combat-style gear. The witnesses to the getaway said they saw three men in black masks fleeing the scene with rifles in hand. Another said it was three white men in military gear. The attackers got into a black SUV with tinted windows and calmly left the scene. Although a black SUV was later found shot up badly, no convincing evidence was ever produced showing how the accused were driving or shooting from the SUV. Moreover, the attorney representing the family said the accused appeared to have been handcuffed and lying face down in the vehicle when found. As with 9/11, the accused were conveniently dead. The 14 people killed in San Bernardino were just like the nearly 3,000 killed on 9/11. They were sacrificial lottery winners, murdered not simply by the perpetrators of the crime, but by fellow citizens who continue to ignore the facts about terrorist events. The lack of objective examination of terrorist acts suggests that we might as well stone to death future victims because it is the public's apathy that allows terrorism to continue. Who will be next? As with Shirley Jackson's novel, we are all in the lottery of terrorism. Unless we take action to investigate and communicate the facts about terrorist events, our names will remain in the pool to be selected at random. Only a concerted and persistent effort to question each new terrorist act, as well as those of the last few decades, will remove our names from the list. And now we're going to hear the audio from a video called The 10 Characteristics of a False Flag. And this was produced by TruthStreamMedia.com on October 7th, 2017. And I believe the woman speaking is Melissa Dykes.
For decades now, governments around the world have admitted to committing false flag attacks to further geopolitical and other aims. What's a false flag attack? Simply put, it's a covert operation designed to deceive in such a way that the event is made to appear as if it was carried out by individuals, groups, or nations other than those who actually planned and executed them. Many false flag attacks, including those perpetrated by the American government, have now been exposed, including Operation Northwoods.
From the CIA and other places, secretly create terrorism in the United States. The documents actually said they had a very complex plan where they were going to take an aircraft and load it with CIA people who look like college students, fly it over to have it take off from an airport in Miami with a lot of publicity. And then it would quickly, after it got into the air, land at a secret CIA base. At that same time, an identical plane would take off from that CIA base, except this plane would be empty, and it'd be remotely piloted from the ground. It was a drone plane that would be very similar to the passenger plane that had just taken off. And once the plane was over Cuba, there was going to be a tape recorder that would have played a distress call to a microphone saying, help, we're being shot at. And a few minutes later, once the plane was over the Caribbean Sea, after it passed over Cuba, it would have, somebody would have pressed a button on the ground, blowing up the plane, and they would have blamed Cuba for killing a plane load of American college students.
The Gulf of Tonkin incident that spurred America's official entrance into the Vietnam War.
The Gulf of Tonkin resolution was not a declaration of war. There never was a declaration of war in Vietnam, but it served much the same purpose. The president was given broad powers to wage war. But what the Congress did not know, what the country did not know, is that the second attack in the Gulf of Tonkin may never have happened.
The FBI's COINTELPRO campaign, which involved the use of provocateurs to carry out violent acts and falsely blame them on political activists from the 1950s to the 1970s, to the anthrax letters that began showing up in the mail in the wake of 9/11, ending in the death of Sun photo editor Robert Stevens. The Bush administration tried to pressure then-FBI Director Robert Mueller to publicly blame the letters on bin Laden, despite the fact that it was well known the anthrax was a military strain, and even the FBI couldn't come up with a halfway plausible story of how guys in caves with box cutters could supposedly wind up in possession of weapons-grade anthrax. But what about all the false flags that the government hasn't admitted to yet? In light of Las Vegas, people have been asking, how do you know if an event is a false flag or not?
sure just like many of you, I woke up this morning to the devastating news coming out of Las Vegas.
Shocking and painful tragedy, this time in Las Vegas.
Once again, people had gathered for music and fun, only to hear this. Instead,
it was somebody shooting a fully automatic.
People just started screaming and running.
These shootings are just absolutely difficult, if not impossible, to defense against.
Anytime you have a high-profile event that doesn't pass the sniff test, here are some red flags to look for that might denote a false flag event. First, you'll notice that it's such a high-profile event that it's all the mainstream media will talk about 24/7.
We're going to take a moment here, and we are going to kind of gather things and start off the top here at 1 o'clock with all the information that we know, because we know people are tuning in here and there, and they're turning on, and they haven't quite heard everything and everything that they need to know.
Creating a news bubble around the event as if it's the only thing going on in the entire world.
Aftermath in Vinnenden proved so compelling for the vulture-like rolling news stations, they even filled their time showing things that weren't happening yet.
This type of incessant coverage has not only been proven to encourage copycat acts by the reverse glorification of mass murderers, which is well known to the mainstream media.
This particular kind of media coverage of mass murder, I think there are three untoward effects. The first is copycat mass murderers.
Repeatedly showing us a killer's face isn't news, it's just rubbernecking. This sort of coverage only serves to turn this murdering little twat into a sort of nihilistic pin-up boy.
But the repetitive emotional arousal of 24/7 news coverage of mass murders is known to cause psychological trauma and damage to the people who consume it.
Terrorist event.
Terrorists.
Terrorist alert.
Terrorist threat.
Terrorist target.
Terrorism.
Terrorist attack. So many attacks.
You saw it here live.
At the very least, imparting a sense of learned helplessness in the viewers, which can further other aims.
And what it all comes down to is the process of desensitization. And I think the most important factor here is we've all been desensitized.
Number two, you know it's suspicious when the police and the mainstream media almost immediately present a neatly packaged, comprehensive narrative, and within 24 hours, it's case closed. You'll notice the media never questions the official narrative, even when there are obvious unanswered questions or blatantly conflicting eyewitness accounts. And even though the crime just happened, and it's perfectly obvious to anyone paying attention there hasn't been enough time to follow up on all the leads, you'll notice that any other theories that deviate from the official package narrative are denied airtime and discounted immediately, despite how compelling they are. Like, say, you probably never heard of the fact that the family of the San Bernardino shooters claimed they were framed for a false flag.
Where the couple was found, from what I understand, is that they were handcuffed, lying face down in this truck, shot up. There's a lot of things that just don't make sense.
Or the fact that many witnesses and even early media reports of the Oklahoma City bombing told of secondary explosive devices found in the Murrah Federal Building.
The second explosive was found and defused.
I think he said another bomb.
Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found.
They then found a third device, which was also larger than the first.
Reports which were all discounted later in lieu of the official story. The media will also frequently discount stories of multiple shooters, or in the case of Oklahoma City, multiple bombers, sometimes correcting witnesses on air, or even cutting them off.
How much shooting was going on and then not being taken down, and like I said, there is definitely someone on the ground.
Did you have any friends at this concert? Is there anyone that you don't know?
Humanly possible way that guy, that was the only shooter. If you were where we were and how we were hidden and the way they came in and herded us all out into the staff parking lot and then continued shooting into the staff parking lot.
The Las Vegas Police Department is saying that they do believe that it is just one person at this point, but they believe that it came from the 32nd floor.
Only the way there was a lot of headshots. So the way a lot of people got headshots and it was, yeah, like the guy, right. Yeah,
we're gonna wind it right there.
Number three, you'll notice the suspects are usually either taken out or they commit suicide, making sure there's no one to prosecute and no trial, making it much easier to frame a patsy. Number four, another red flag is that the suspects of these crimes usually have hardly any training, yet they're able to carry off grand attacks with amazing precision. It just doesn't make any sense. A good example of this would be supposed hijacker Hani Hanjour, who we are told flew a Boeing 757 into the Pentagon on 9/11 in a maneuver so tricky, some experienced commercial pilots say it's frankly impossible. This is despite the fact that multiple witnesses, including flight instructors who flew with Hondur just weeks prior to the attack, said the guy could barely control and land a single-engine Cessna 172. The FAA has still never explained how Hondur was even able to obtain a commercial pilot's license to begin with, as most every flight school and instructor he worked with has come out on the record to say that he was a terrible pilot.
They are known to have taken some flight lessons with small single-engine airplanes. None of them had ever flown a jet before in their life, let alone a large commercial airliner. Debunkers maintain that the terrorist had spent some time in flight simulators, and that the equipment they encountered in the Boeing cockpits on September 11 was similar to the simulators they had trained on. This is false. For example, the only simulator Hani Hondur is known to have ever trained in is the Boeing 737, an airplane designed in the 70s, with a totally different cockpit from the 757 he is alleged to have hijacked on September 11.
We're also supposed to just readily accept without question that many of these mass shooters are somehow able to fire upon large crowds, sometimes from great distances, wearing large amounts of military gear, without loss of speed and with expert accuracy, despite having no military or weapons training beforehand whatsoever. It just makes no sense. Number 5. Drills. Many times there are drills involving the exact scenario of the attack happening around the same time or even simultaneously as the attack goes down, which helps to ensure that the false flag itself will be able to be carried out without too much interruption, because a lot of people in the confusion will think it's just a drill. A long list of drills and war games were taking place on 9/11. And during the Aurora shooting, there was a government-sponsored anti-terror training drill, specifically regarding a massacre in a movie theater. Not only was a drill going on during the Boston Marathon bombing, but pictures taken directly afterwards show crisis actors walking through the bomb scene looking totally confused, like this woman who comes out of a shop down the street from the finish line seconds after the bomb goes off with her leg already wrapped up as if she's hurt, then walks through the bomb scene with a look of horror on her face like she's confused. A drill of the exact scenario was going down during the London 7/7 bombings as well.
Today we were running an exercise for a company, bearing in mind I'm now in the private sector, and we sat everybody down in the city, 1,000 people involved in the whole organisation, but the crisis team. And the most peculiar thing was we based our scenario on the simultaneous attacks on the underground and mainline station. So we had to suddenly switch an exercise from fictional to real.
6. People in high places appear to have been forewarned about the event well before it happened. One of the earliest examples of this is Pearl Harbor, the event that officially got America into World War II.
This is a Life magazine from September 24th, 1945. For a long time, the official explanation of Pearl Harbor was that we were slugged without warning when we were innocently going about our business. Slugged we were, but there's no need to explain Japanese behavior. But to say that we were slugged without warning is a radical distortion of the truth. Roosevelt, the chief executive of the nation and the commander-in-chief of its army and navy, knew in advance that the Japanese were going to attack us. And it goes on further in the article to point this out, that they may not have known the precise location of the attack, but the Japanese code had been solved for some time. And they knew that they were launching an attack against us, and we were not preparing our Army and Navy and Air Force to withstand that attack. In fact, in many cases, what we were doing was even making sure that we could be attacked.
9/11's another good example. People were warned not to show up for work on what otherwise should have been an ordinary Tuesday, including World Trade Center complex leaseholder Larry Silverstein and his daughter, whose bodyguards, according to Luke Radowski of We Are Change, received a phone call warning them on the morning of 9/11 not to come to work either. Not only that, but how did this BBC reporter know that Building 7, which was never even hit by a plane, just by the way, was about to collapse into its footprint well before it did?
And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy. There's almost a sense downtown in New York behind me, down by the World Trade Centers, of just an area completely closed off as the rescue workers try to do their job. As you can see behind me, the Trade Center appears to be still burning. We see these huge clouds of smoke and ash, and we know that behind that, there's an empty piece of what was a very familiar New York skyline.
Number 7. The accused has ties to military intelligence or intelligence agencies, including the FBI and the CIA. As activist post Brandon Turbeville points out, a connection to any one of these organizations and institutions may go some length in explaining how the attack was coordinated, the motivation of the perpetrators, the actual involvement or not of the suspects, and who actually directed the operation. The Sarnaev brothers, a.k.a. the Boston Marathon bombing patsies, had been on the FBI's radar long before the attack, but it also later came out they had deeper ties to a covert CIA initiative in Chechnya. Many of the supposed 9/11 hijackers were also connected to the FBI and CIA beforehand. Accused Orlando nightclub shooter Omar Mateen was not only working for a high-level government defense contractor, but he too had long been on the FBI's radar and had in fact been introduced to FBI informants when he was followed and had all his communications spied on by the agency for 10 months in 2013. Number 8 involves mysterious witness deaths. In the 3-year period which followed the murders of JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald, 18 material witnesses died. 6 by gunfire, 3 in motor accidents, 2 by suicide, 3 from heart attacks, 1 from a cutthroat, 1 from a karate chop to the neck, and only 2 were deemed from natural causes. By the end of the 70s, however, those mysterious deaths of JFK witnesses or people linked to the case was closer to 100. A little over a month after the Boston Marathon bombing, Special Agents Christopher Lorick and Stephen Shaw, two members of the elite FBI counterterrorism unit that arrested Dokar Sarnaev, died by falling a significant distance out of a helicopter that encountered unspecified difficulties 12 miles off the coast of Virginia Beach. Multiple friends of the Sarnaev brothers, including Tamerlan's best friend Brendan Mess, were also murdered in the weeks following the bombing. SEAL Team 6, the U.S. Naval Special Warfare Development Group that were told took out Osama bin Laden in 2007 in a raid on his compound, despite the fact that bin Laden was reportedly a longtime CIA asset named Tim Osman, who had died in 2001 of a degenerative genetic disease known as Marfan syndrome that doesn't have a cure, with insiders claiming the U.S. government had just been waiting to wheel bin Laden's body out in whatever time would be most politically expedient, but that's another story for another time, so let's go back to SEAL Team 6. We're told that just a few months after the raid, more than 20 members of the elite team were reported to have died in a helicopter crash, which the Taliban officially took credit for, though many have said it was to get rid of witnesses to the raid.
The locals in the neighborhood say that the operation led by the United States military was a complete hoax.
Osama was never here.
Just over a year after the Oklahoma City bombing, OKC police officer Terry Yeakey, one of the first on the scene, died in what appeared to be a vicious murder that was somehow ruled a suicide. Supposedly this is how he killed himself. He's said to have slit his wrists and neck, which caused him to nearly bleed to death in his car, but then he miraculously was able to climb over a barbed wire fence and then walk over a mile through a nearby field, eventually shooting himself in the side of the head at an unusual angle, and no weapon was found at the scene where his body was.
He was brutally murdered. Mile and a half from the front gate of the El Reno Penitentiary. From that moment that his body was found, we know that the crime scene was destroyed. There were spade shovels that were used to turn over the crime scene. Ballistics, any gunpowder residue, anything that had to do with his death was completely destroyed. It was corrupted.
Going along with number 8, number 9, the mysterious disappearance of evidence and the classification of evidence. There are so many examples of this, it's hard to even limit how many I'm going to use here, but remember when the press was given unprecedented access to the suspected San Bernardino shooter's apartment right after the shooting to rifle through everything and trample any evidence that might be there and completely contaminate what should have been an open crime scene? Or how about the fact that 6 months after the Sandy Hook shooting, the Connecticut House of Representatives passed an unprecedented legislation preventing the public release of crime scene photos and video evidence from the shooting, including any records that could, quote, reasonably be expected to constitute an unwarranted invasion of the privacy of the victim or the victim's surviving family members, end quote. A few months after that, construction crews completely demolished the former Sandy Hook Elementary School. Or how about, despite being one of the most heavily filmed buildings on the planet, there has never been a release of any footage ever showing a plane hitting the Pentagon on 9/11. Just after the attack there, I remember clearly seeing clips on television of a line of people walking across the Pentagon lawn, picking things up with their bare hands. Which not only goes against any real crime scene investigation protocol, but is something that doesn't even happen in crime scene protocol on television shows which aren't real, let alone at one of the most infamous crime scenes of one of the biggest crimes of the 21st century.
It appeared that that Boeing 757, the American Airlines jet, landed short of the Pentagon. Can you give us any better idea of how much of the plane actually impacted the building?
You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon and then caused the side to collapse. Now, even though if you look at the pictures of the Pentagon, you see that the floors have all collapsed. That didn't happen immediately. It wasn't until almost about 45 minutes later.
In the immediate aftermath, the World Trade Center debris piles were locked down, and 50,000 tons of mangled steel from the Twin Towers were sold at a discount of just $120 a ton and shipped to China, where they were quickly recycled. By September 29th, not even a month later, 130,000 tons of debris had already been removed from the site. Fire experts later told Congress that about 80% of the steel was scrapped without being examined because investigators didn't have the authority to preserve the wreckage. Or how about the fact in 2010 a judge held that CIA documents associated with the Oklahoma City bombing case would remain classified 15 years after the fact? Or the fact that they just keep pushing back the release date of some 6,000 JFK assassination documents, which supposedly will finally be released in 2028, but since they push it back every single time, we're not holding our breath. And finally, number 10, qui bono, who benefits? Always ask who benefits. First, ask whether or not the official narrative has any obvious political advantages to the government. The ISIS and lone wolf terror narratives are at this point fear-based programming cues which urge the public to hand over more and more of their civil rights and freedoms while basically giving more power over to the government, while at the same time justifying more foreign intervention and empire-building wars. While they push emotional buttons, these narratives usually also push patriotic ones as well, which is another pro-government plus. Also, check if there was any pre-planned legislation that fits the event like a glove, and if that was already in the works. A good example is the way that 9/11 was used as justification to implement the Orwellian-named Constitution-Burning Patriot Act, which had been written well before 9/11. Another benefit to many involved, 9/11 was also used to start an offensive, nebulous, and never-ending war on terror, which began in Iraq, a country that President Bush himself later admitted on record he had a really tough time connecting to bin Laden or the so-called war on terror.
You know, one of the hardest parts of my job is to connect Iraq to the war on terror.
Although sometimes the benefit is as simple as flipping the script away from something the public at large was focused on that the establishment would like to make go away, and fast. Finally, look for financial beneficiaries, which include but are not limited to major banks, corporations, and defense contractors, as is the case in the underwear bomber Chertoff Group rapiscan controversy. Or the fact that Larry Silverstein had taken out a 99-year lease on the World Trade Center complex just 6 weeks before 9/11 and attempted to argue in court that the two planes hitting the towers constituted two separate terrorist attacks so that he could receive double the insurance payout. The list goes on and on and on here, way beyond the few examples of the many out there. But hey, at least this is a good place to start.
No, it's a funny thing how certain things turn out to be fact in history books. Our government will lie, and that lie will become a fact.
So if you haven't looked into the Oklahoma City bombings, 9/11, Orlando, San Bernardino, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Mandalay Bay, and many of the others that I've left out, you really owe it to yourself to do so. The evidence might really surprise you. We, the citizens, can't stop these attacks if we don't know who's behind them. Please do your research and spread the word. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. West Virginia teachers defy state law and union to stage successful wildcat strike. Are Oklahoma and Arizona next? We are very pleased to have with us from around the country, actually, Erica Newsom, English teacher at Chapmansville High School in Logan County, West Virginia. Teresa Danks, a third-grade teacher from Grimes Elementary School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Derek Harris, a middle school band teacher. Sorry, my favorite. Tucson Unified District, Arizona. This is from somebody who used to play the sousaphone, which was bigger than I was at the time.
Is that Derek?
So, so I have a real affinity for Derek. Thank you all for joining us. And let's, of course, begin with West Virginia. If we could take out the noisemakers and the blowers and the strike up the marching bands, kudos for the enormity of the conviction, the unity, and what was accomplished in this strike, which has really brought heart to, I think, labor activists around the country. So why don't you give us your take on what happened? What brought all this to a culmination in West Virginia? And, of course, thank all of you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. And of all the wildcat strikes, I had the honor and privilege of being part of the very first one, which included only three counties in southern West Virginia. There's a couple of factors why that was so. This was to be the third year that the public employees were the only ones absorbing the increased cost of health care. Now, we understand health care costs are going up everywhere, but yeah, and we're always told, you know, we can't pay our teachers the most, but you will always have excellent benefits in retirement and health care. And, you know, it was just, I can't remember last time we had a cost of living raise. They gave us a little tiny bump early in the 2000s or so, but the last one raised was the last strike in 1990, 28 years ago. And I think it just all came to a head, and then everybody got the information about being required or having an extra $25 a month added to your monthly premium if you didn't participate in a literal tracking program called 365 Go, where they track your biometrics. They ask you very personal health questions. You're required to download their app and everything like that. And so it was just a, you know, combination of all those things. And we're talking some about the unions. And I'm a member of, you know, West Virginia's NEA chapter, and I really like the people I've worked with through there. But it is true, they did try to, they tried to get us to be more patient. And the part of West Virginia that the three counties are in that went out on the first wildcat strike, we experienced the mine wars, like the early 1900s, 1920, where, you know, the United Mine Workers tried to organize, and they were met with violence from our own U.S. military. You might win, you know, you're richer than us, you're more powerful than us, you might win. But if there is any chance at all that we can make a difference, you know, and their solution is to lower the standards instead of raising our race to barely a cost of living rate.
Let me just stop you for 1 minute, Erica, and that's just because our line here is a bit muddy, and you're saying too many important things to miss. So we're going to ask you, while we continue the conversation with Teresa and Derek, I'm going to ask you if you can hang up, and we're going to call you back directly, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Right, sounds good.
So we're going to just pick up from there while we're reaching out to Erica on a better phone line. Teresa, Derek, what are some of your thoughts based on some of the things that Sister Erica was saying?
Teresa?
Well, I was going to say it sounds like we're marching in the same band in a lot of ways here in Oklahoma. We definitely, we had our last walkout strike in 1990 here, and we haven't seen anything positive happen in 28 years. In the last 20 years, teachers have been making appointments to see legislators, picketing at the Capitol, and teachers in Oklahoma have, we're now 50th out of 50, so we can't go any lower, and for pay, and we haven't had a raise in Oklahoma since 2008, and I guess walkout momentum that's grown in Oklahoma, you know, definitely we were inspired by West Virginia, but it's definitely been brewing here for a few years now, and we had a bill called Step Up Oklahoma that failed in February, and that really kind of lit a fire under people, and so me as well as some other teachers started really reaching out to teachers, trying to bring teachers together collectively to see how they felt, and numbers grew very quickly in that so many people across the state were just ready to walk out. Very fed up here. I call it righteous anger. They are very angry because, like she said, in West Virginia, we expect better and we believe that our children deserve to be educated just as well as any children in any other state. And we can't keep our, we can't recruit new teachers. We can't retain teachers. And we have a lot of teachers that are close to retirement, and what is now a crisis could easily be a tragedy within the next 6 months. We fear that buildings won't open next fall if they do not do something very soon.
Teresa, from what I understand, the union itself is getting involved in the call for the walkout this time, which is not something that happened initially in West Virginia.
Yes. Now, our union did not get involved right off the bat. It was, I think, after a lot of pressure from their members and so many teachers coming together that they did get on board. There's some controversy over whether or not what they're asking. They came up with a plan. So we really were fighting for a $10,000 raise just to bring us somewhat competitive to our region. And they pulled out a plan that would be $6,000 the first year, then $2,000, and then $2,000. But there's other bills that, if they pass, could take that completely out of the legislators' hands and put things back in the local school district. So that could possibly create where that other money doesn't go to the teachers. So there's, you know, there's a lot of people that are still frustrated and not sure what's going to happen. And so we're just trying to keep the momentum moving forward. And we do have the support for our walkout. The date is set for April 2nd. So if legislator hasn't come back with something here in Oklahoma by the 1st, then we are having a statewide shutdown on April 2nd.
And we're going to move to Derek Harris. And when I said Zuzaphone, somebody said Z-O-O. Well, I'm from Brooklyn. It's John Philip Sousa. I got it. But that's
right.
How we said it at General John J. Pershing Junior High School. So we are now speaking with our band teacher in middle school, Derek Harris, from Tucson Unified District, Arizona. And we do have Erica Newsom back on the line, and she'll join us again in a moment. Derek, what's happening in Tucson, Arizona?
Well, our effort is not you know, not localized. We're branched out across the state, trying to get as branched out as we can. We are just barely getting up on our feet for this, but you know, just like in Oklahoma and West Virginia, people have been mad about this since the financial crisis in 2008. we had $1 billion cut from our public education budget in 2010, and all of the efforts that have gone into adjusting that, trying to recoup any of that loss, hasn't even been a drop in the bucket. I mean, even this year, the governor has proposed a $150 million budget increase for us, and that's not even a tenth of what's been cut, and it wouldn't even get us from 49th to 48th. It wouldn't even approach trying to make that move. So, you know, we have issues with insurance as well. We have budgets that have been passed lately that have shifted the burden onto the employees away from the districts, and the state's role in a lot of this has been, well, the districts should control themselves, and we just can't afford to keep funding these schools, and yet Arizona is the testing ground for a lot of charter schools.
Hmm. So we're bringing Erica back into the picture, and we cut you off, but we have a much better line now. So do you think you could pick up where you left off, Erica?
I'm kind of trying to remember where exactly we left off. Just speaking of the Wildcat strikes, the three counties that went out first, and that was one of them, you know, the lady from Oklahoma was talking about, like, just anger that really seemed to be catching on. And a lot of it is historical because of the mine wars that happened in this area around the turn of the 20th century. And people here have a long memory. And those people, those coal miners who wanted to form a union were actually, many of them were killed, you know, for wanting to demonstrate that and lost about everything they had. So you have people coming in and telling us that this is an illegal strike, but that doesn't really fly here. And it didn't really scare anybody whatsoever.
I want to know why, if I may, because I know that in my own union, and I've got a pretty wonderful shop, but nevertheless, even about filing a grievance, when the union proper is tentative about processing a grievance, particularly a shop-wide grievance, we generally capitulate. So I understand the incredible history of labor in West Virginia, but what brought this to a crescendo? Why weren't people more afraid of a reactionary governor, of a union that felt that its tactics had been exhausted and was certainly not encouraging such an action? Tell us a little bit more about really what made people come out in mass and drew the support of the community.
Yeah, and the community support has been just phenomenal. As to why they weren't really intimidated, I guess there's two schools of thought there. One of which, like I said, amount of openings for teachers and how many classrooms have uncertified teachers and are overcrowded classes because their kids don't have anywhere else to go, is at about a crisis level right now. So what are they going to do? Are they going to, they can't spare a single teacher to fire, let alone the entire state or, you know, the majority of the teachers of the state or even within our counties. Fire everybody in Logan County. There's not people lined up to work there. And on the other hand, we have this idea of what else do we have to lose? You know, and I'm sorry to be a little cliche, but I've always been a big Game of Thrones fan. And it just reminded me a lot of what Cersei said in one of the episodes. She says, so we'll fight and die, or we'll submit and die. But I know my choice. And I think that was the general feeling, right? Like, what else is there to lose?
Derek, in terms of what else there is to lose, do you think that if the governor and the legislature increases the school budget, that they'll take it out of other programs for the poor and for other people in the state?
Yeah, that is a concern that we have. And we have not, you know, made any demands yet to anybody. We're still in the formulation side of that thing. But we've been watching the news as it comes through about West Virginia, and we're concerned about what could happen if we make demands and not get super specific about things. Fortunately, we have some people that are willing to help us with that research. But, you know, for instance, we keep lowering corporate the corporate business tax in Arizona to, you know, quote unquote, invite businesses in. But at the same time, it allows predatory charter schools to come in and really take, you know, we have a voucher system here that allows people to take thousands of dollars of taxpayer money and just drop it into a private entity. And then, you know, there's no, it doesn't benefit the public schools at all. So we have these little nuanced issues that we have to deal with for sure.
And I want to go back to Teresa Dank, third grade teacher in Grimes Elementary School. Talk about what the conditions are like. Talk about what it means to teach there and what you think about the way teachers and thus children are treated and what that says about the priorities of this country.
Well, we have, the circumstances vary a little bit from district to district, but we have teachers that literally can't, they and their students have to keep their coats on all day because the temperature is so cold in the classroom. We have lights that are burned out and half the building is closed. We have bathrooms that should probably not be used. The facilities are that bad. We have teachers that are being limited to 30 copies a day or a week. We have teachers like myself that are providing so many of their own hands-on manipulatives and games and resources to enrich and engage the children into the curriculum. I always try to explain to people if they don't understand what hands-on learning is. I was on the Harry Connick Jr. show, and I say, you know, if Harry Connick Jr. was only allowed to learn how to play the piano by watching it on a video or reading it out of a book, how good would he be today? Mm. And I'm like, everybody learns best when they can get their hands on things. And we've become this society of workbook pages and filling in bubbles and just, you know, pencil and paper. And some schools sadly aren't even providing that. But I spend thousands of dollars every year to give my children what they need. And also when you're working in an urban city school district with a lot of low-income families, these children don't hardly leave their communities or their state, and so they don't have prior knowledge to fall back on. So we work even extra hard to try to bring as much of the world to them as possible so that they can better understand it and have a better, an authentic learning experience that will stay with them. So we are frustrated on so many levels. We feel disrespected in our profession. We are scripted. We've had a curriculum rollout that literally scripts us on what to say. A lot of teachers are very offended by that. We are micromanaged. We have a very top-heavy system with, and all this top-heavy administration, they all make really good incomes, six-figure incomes. Our legislators make six-figure incomes and want to tell us how to do our jobs, and there's just very little respect there. And so you put that together with the low pay and the high insurance costs and the increasing class sizes and not having the resources you need. And teachers are literally, they're at a boiling point, and they are just, they're erupting.
You know, if I may add into what something that Erica, or one of the questions you'd asked about, why haven't, you know, teachers done something to this point, you know, why now and stuff like that. Teachers in general, you know, we live in these environments where we have to take care of all these students and these families connected to those students. And whenever we, a lot of times, you know, when you see teachers bringing their own materials into the classroom that they purchased out of their own pay, it's because we want so much for everything to just work. We just want it to be possible for the students to learn and do the best they can with what meager little we have. And so for a long time, teachers have just kind of been saying, well, we'll make it work. Well, we'll make it work. And it's just not, you know, as my local union president says, they've already cut all the fat. Now it's meat and bone. Mm.
And Derek, in terms of the attacks on public sector unions, as exemplified by the Janus case in the Supreme Court, which a lot of people think are going to weaken public sector unions, is this kind of mobilization the antidote to that, or at least part of the antidote?
Well, I mean, you know, it's that's hard to say. You know, the group that I'm with, while I am a member of my union, the group that I'm actually organizing with is not connected to any of the unions, And we're just gathering as much steam as we can. You know, Arizona's a right-to-work state, and so we fight for every member that we can get. It would be great if we were able to secure more people into the unions, because we know that with numbers comes more voices, and with more voices comes the ability to get the respect that we deserve in ways that make sense for us to have.
Erica Newsom, what do you think some of the lessons are, or if you want to respond to any of the things that Teresa or Derek said, all of that's good.
Yeah, so a couple of things that Derek said. First, just a mention of the funding. The idea that the funding is coming from like Medicaid, Medicare and stuff, it was all based on one comment that Senator Blair said, who is the he's the finance committee chair, and he's been outspoken against us since the beginning. He says, we're going to find the money somewhere. I guess we'll have to check with Medicaid and stuff. And that even that same day, the governor sat down and said, we're not touching Medicare or Medicaid. And the unions put out the percentages of where the funding was coming from. Was it Medicare or Medicaid? That's, you know, even within our own, like, movement, we still have people thinking that. And so when I started being active in this way back in the fall, I understood that it was a war of information. And like I said, I'm generally pro-union and everything, but Derek is also right on in terms of not just working with people within your union. A lot of those people are marching in West Virginia. We're not part of any union. We had our own group, West Virginia Public Employees United, and that's where a lot of the fire got started.
And, of course, in West Virginia, we're talking about a strike that involved more than 20,000 teachers and 13,000 school staffers, and in the final analysis, one for all public workers. And I have to say this, in the middle of Trump country, where he won 68% of the vote. Were you amazed by that?
It's such an odd thing, because West Virginia has only been red for a decade or two. You know, if you sit down and you talk to these people, they have conservative values, but they're not fiscally conservative values. They're socially conservative values. And I think, and like the more you just sit down and talk to these people, they're over it. And like the whole Trump thing, you know, I really, in my heart, think, you know, these are not people who agree with the type of person he is. These are people who were desperate, just desperate to be recognized in some way. Then, you know, Appalachia feels ignored a lot of the time. We feel like we've suffered for all these years. People have come in and taken the minerals and left us with nothing. And so for him to even show up and even do his little play acting about coal and all that, that was enough for a lot of people, just because they had been neglected for so long.
Well, I think what we need to do is have all three of you back and really devote a whole program to looking at the school systems there. I think there's much to learn. And, of course, congratulations to Erica Newsom and our sisters and brothers in West Virginia who set the pace in many ways. And, of course, support for what is happening in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the school district, the Tucson Unified District in Arizona. And I just want to say that, Derek, as a band teacher, in the last 30 seconds, can you do your work? Is there any kind of consideration for the arts and culture within the context of the school system that you teach in?
I'll tell you what I'm dealing with in my work is that I have instruments that are 40 years old that don't work anymore and they're falling apart. I've been forced out of a classroom onto a stage where I have to battle the cafeteria workers for sound. I mean, you know, you're in, anyone that's been in music, you understand that listening is important. And it's really difficult to do our jobs whenever we're not in an environment that's conducive. This year in Arizona, we had 100-degree temperatures and no air conditioning. Mm.
Well, much more to talk about. Real thanks. It's been great to at least get an introduction to you. We will definitely have you back if you're all willing to come back.
Yes,
of course.
And we've been speaking with Derek Harris, middle school band teacher, Tucson Unified District in Arizona, and Teresa Danks, third grade teacher, Grimes Elementary School, Tucson, Oklahoma, and Erica Newsom, English teacher, Chapman High School, Logan County, West Virginia, taught us a hell of a lot for those of us who are convinced that workers have nothing to lose but their chains when they take to the picket line and they take to the strike line.
And we have a world to win.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
And now Rise Again, written and composed by Tom Jerovich.
I can feel the spirit building, soft as a whisper, but loud as a roar. I can feel something is stirring like I never have before. We've been
has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
so much for this moment.
Enormous love to my wife, my rock, Corey Ray.
Love and thanks to my Latino community, to my husband, Ryan.
And I wouldn't be standing up here without the inspired help I received from my life's partners who are gone.
The original Mardi Gras were very political. We were still fighting big battles.
What are you going to do tonight at the party? What can we expect?
I'll just be Cher.
You don't need to do anything more than that.
That's what I'm best at.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Thousands demonstrate against equality in the Philippines. Oscar is still queer at 90, and Sydney's 40th Mardi Gras contrasts Australia's brutal past with a hopeful future. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 10th, 2018. Evangelical Christians are protesting moves by lawmakers in the Philippines to protect people from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. A bill to do just that passed unanimously last year in the lower house of Congress, but opponents have used delaying tactics to prevent a vote in the Senate. Thousands of protesters demonstrated against the bill on March 7th outside the Senate chambers. The so-called Jesus is Lord movement has united under the name of the Coalition of Christians for Righteousness, Justice, and Truth to oppose any advance in LGBT rights. They fear that extending anti-bias protections to LGBT people is a slippery slope to marriage equality. Evangelicals also claim that the anti-bias bill discriminates against people who oppose LGBT equality and is therefore unconstitutional. A local queer activist told reporters that the protest was a testament that morality can never be measured through faith and belief.
The anti-equality demonstration came in the same week that the Philippines Supreme Court finally set a date to hear oral arguments in a challenge to the nation's ban on marriage equality. Openly gay attorney Jesus Falsis III has been waiting since he first filed suit in 2015 for the High Court to hear his case. He's contesting as unconstitutional provisions of the Family Code that deny civil marriage to same-gender couples. Philippine Solicitor General Florin Hilbe told local media that the petition is intrinsically flawed because Falsis has no legal standing to argue the case. This is an invitation to a debate or coffee shop conversation, he said, not a constitutional litigation. Controversial President Rodrigo Duterte has voiced support for opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. However, the Philippines has been described as the bastion of Roman Catholicism in Asia. 8 in 10 of its 100 million people identify as Catholic, so there's no question that the church will exert all its influence to block any progress on LGBT rights. A high court spokesman said that oral arguments in the marriage equality case would be heard on June 19th.
Marriage equality has divided lawmakers in other countries. Right-wing members of El Salvador's legislature are pushing an amendment to the Central American nation's constitution to define marriage as exclusively heterosexual.
Chile's newly elected right-wing president, Sebastián Piñera, has broken with his predecessor, Michelle Bachelet, a vocal marriage equality supporter. A spokeswoman said this week that the Piñera administration will not be prioritizing the bill introduced by Bachelet last year to open the institution to same-gender couples. Secretary of Government Cecilia Pérez said that it's entirely up to lawmakers to advance the bill.
An estimated 10,000 Panamanians held a demonstration on the grounds of the Supreme Court of Justice this week to oppose marriage equality in their country. Led by the Panamanian Alliance for Life and Family, a spokesman said that they will not allow the natural family to be threatened by people and institutions that favor gender ideology. But a government spokesperson said that as a signatory to the American Convention on Human Rights, Panama must abide by a recent decision of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to open civil marriage in the region to same-gender couples.
A majority of the members of the Cayman Islands Legislative Assembly are adamantly opposed to marriage equality, according to a report this week by the Cayman's News Service. Deputy Governor Franz Manderson said the government has been monitoring how the matter is being handled in their fellow British Overseas territory of Bermuda. The news service says that while most Cayman lawmakers don't want to be seen as supporting marriage equality or even civil unions, a number of them, speaking off the record, say that it's only a matter of time before same-gender couples are legally recognized there.
And in Bermuda, a bill revoking court-ordered marriage equality late last year is being challenged in the island nation's Supreme Court. The Domestic Partnership Act of 2017 overturned a Supreme Court marriage equality ruling in May of that year and replaced it with the less-than-equal status of domestic partners for same-gender couples. A government spokesman announced last week that the law would not take effect until June 1st, supposedly to allow already planned weddings to go forward. The Supreme Court announced a few days earlier that it would hear the lawsuit against the Domestic Partnership Act of 2017 in late May. Equality activists were outraged this week by a discussion in the House of Assembly about attracting more queer tourism dollars to the Caribbean island. Leah Scott, deputy opposition leader and shadow tourism minister, said that while she did not support marriage equality, the LGBTQ community spends money, and they spend big money. Rod Ferguson, the plaintiff in the challenge to the Domestic Partnership Act of 2017, called the discussion about attracting more queer tourists to the island pretty ballsy. The Rainbow Alliance advocacy group said in a media statement that, if the government seeks to make Bermuda more hospitable for the LGBTQ community, it should start with its own citizens.
Out and generally non-controversial TV talk show host Ellen DeGeneres took to Twitter this week to call for a boycott of the island. Bermuda just banned marriage equality, she wrote. I guess I'm canceling my trip. Anybody else? Local queer activists point out, however, that LGBT people who work in Bermuda's tourism industry would also be adversely impacted by a serious economic boycott. Ferguson, the marriage equality lawsuit plaintiff, said he was opposed to a boycott, but that, unfortunately, you reap what you sow, quickly adding that, neither can I ask LGBT foreigners to visit a place that has made such a publicly hostile statement to the world on how the majority, but not all, of its population feels about them.
Elsewhere, another U.S. federal appeals court has added its voice to the debate about whether or not federal civil rights laws that ban bias based on sex protect LGBT people. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit ruled on March 7th that a Michigan funeral home illegally fired a transgender woman. The employer claimed that there was a provision of 1993's Religious Freedom Restoration Act that allowed him to discriminate based on his religious beliefs. The Sixth Circuit became the first federal appeals court to reject a faith-based rationale for anti-queer discrimination. In a ruling for Amy Stevens and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a federal agency that brought the case, the court decided that anti-transgender discrimination is prohibited by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans discrimination on the basis of sex, and that employing a transgender person posed no substantial burden on the employer's religious freedom. The 49-page opinion, written by Judge Karen Nelson Moore, said that discrimination against employees, either because of their failure to conform to sex stereotypes or their transgender and transitioning status, is illegal under Title VII. The appeals court sent the case back to the lower district court that had ruled in the funeral home's favor to review the case in light of the appellate court's reading of the laws. Moore also wrote that, as a matter of law, tolerating Stevens' understanding of her sex and gender identity is not tantamount to supporting it. Another federal appeals court, the New York-based Second Circuit, ruled just last week that Title VII's ban on sex discrimination also extends to sexual orientation. Other federal courts have decided that Title VII offers no anti-bias protection to LGBT people. The Alliance Defending Freedom, a conservative Christian legal group representing the funeral home, has hinted at a further appeal. They're already representing Colorado's Masterpiece Cake Shop in a religious-based anti-gay discrimination case being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court.
And finally, the Board of Aldermen of Starkville, Mississippi, voted this week to approve a special event permit for the city's first-ever LGBT Pride Parade. The action reversed the widely reported 4-3 rejection of the permit last week. The March 7th reconsideration resulted in a 3-3 tie that Mayor Lynn Spruill broke with her vote in favor. She had strongly criticized the original rejection. One alderman abstained this time. Aside from the bad publicity the story has brought to the city of about 25,000 people, home to Mississippi State University, lawmakers no doubt succumbed to the looming lawsuit filed on behalf of the student-led Starkville Pride by famed lawyer Roberta Kaplan. The Mississippi native is best known as the lead attorney in the successful U.S. Supreme Court challenge to DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which had allowed states and the federal government to refuse to recognize the legal marriages of same-gender couples. That high court ruling striking down DOMA in 2013 laid the foundation for the justice's decision to open civil marriage to same-gender couples across the U.S. 2 years later. Kaplan called the March 7th reversal a victory not only for our clients and for their equal dignity under the law, but also for the core principle that in this country we do not restrict a person's ability to speak based on whether or not we agree with what they have to say. The Pride Parade is scheduled for May 24th. Kaplan says she can't wait.
And that's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 10th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
Mardi Gras is one of our favourite events because people are in such a good mood. We need to respond with the type of policing that our LGBTIQ community understand and appreciate.
Four decades make for a different tune. Later in the program. Oscar was not too old at 90 to spring some historic queer surprises at the annual Academy Awards on March 4th. In the Best Foreign Language Film winner, A Fantastic Woman, Daniela Vega plays a trans woman mourning the death of her partner. At the Oscars, Vega became the ceremony's first openly transgender presenter when she introduced the performance of one of the Best Song nominees.
Thank you so much for this moment. I want to invite you to open your heart and your feelings to feel the reality, to feel love. Can you feel it?
Remember Me from Coco was the song Vega introduced, and it went on to win Best Song. Coco producers Darla K. Anderson and Adrian Molina each acknowledged their significant others in accepting the Oscar for Best Animated Feature.
Thank you to the Academy. We're so happy. Coco is proof that art can change and connect the world, and this can only be done when we have a place for everyone and anyone who feels like an other to be heard. This is dedicated with enormous love to my gigantic interwoven family, and most especially, my wife, my rock, Corey Ray.
Love and thanks to my family, my Latino community, to my husband, Ryan, each for expanding my sense of what it means to be proud of who you are and where you're from. We hope the same thing for everyone who connected with this film.
Oh, to see without my eyes the first time that you kissed me.
Trailblazing, out and proud writer James Ivory took on a tall task with a young gay man's intergenerational sexual coming-of-age story in Call Me By Your Name, but he was rewarded with the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay.
My rule number one for a screenwriter who adapts a novel is first thank the author, Andre Aciman, who wrote the story about first love and who's here tonight, a story familiar to most of us, whether we're straight or gay or somewhere in between. We've all gone through first love, I hope, and come out the other side mostly intact. Though maybe not without the benefit of loving parents like the Perlmans in this film. And I wouldn't be standing up here without the inspired help I received from my life's partners, who are gone, our writer Ruth Javala, who received this award twice, and our fearless producer, Ismail Merchant. Working with them for close to 50 years at Merchant Ivory led me to this award. Thank you very much, everyone.
Best Adapted Screenplay Academy Award winner James Ivory also made history on March 4th by becoming the oldest ever Oscar winner at the age of 89.
Actor's life is gay. It's great to be a celebrity, an actor's life for me.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what This Way Out does as well, right here on this station.
Couldn't ask for a brighter star than Cher to shine on your party, but the real headliner on Saturday, March 3rd, was the 40th Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Parade, celebrating the monumental achievements LGBTQ Australians have won in the last 40 years. This Way Out's Barry McKay reports on the 2018 edition of one of the world's favorite parties with a purpose.
Special guest at the party this year. Cher was watching the parade with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. Cher spoke to SBS Television Australia's Joel Creasy during their broadcast of the event.
Cher, welcome to Mardi Gras 2018, the 40th anniversary. Can I just say I'm freaking out a little to meet you?
Thank you.
You look absolutely fantastic. How's the night been? You, the crowd have just gone off for you.
It's fabulous. I actually wanted to just kind of... I've been here watching the parade for a little while. So it's just... it's beautiful. Everyone's having such a wonderful time. Feels so... wholesome.
Absolutely, absolutely. Can you, do most people freak out like this when they meet you? Are they like shaking like I am right now?
It depends. Sometimes.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, she's touching me.
It always makes me curious, but...
Well, you're so fabulous and you've been such a supporter of our community. What do your LGBTQI fans mean to you?
Well, you know, I've known gay people since I was 9 years old.
Yes.
And I also have seen, you know, I know about... Stonewall. I've seen firsthand what people have had to go through, and I'm so happy that finally everyone is not having to take their life in their hand to be who they are.
Yes. I love your Twitter. I also love it when you troll Donald Trump. Thank you so much for
yes,
that, if you
okay.
can keep that up.
Yes, I will, forever and ever, until he's gone.
Oh, yes, we've heard it from Cher. And Cher, of course, last year Australia got marriage equality. We would like to introduce you to one of the pioneers of the marriage equality debate, Magda Szczebanski.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Wonderful to meet you. Thank you for all that you've done for our community. I particularly wanted to ask, and everyone wants to know, what are you going to do tonight at the party? What can we expect?
Well, I'll just be Cher.
You don't need to do anything more than that.
That's what I'm best at.
If you could turn back time, what would you do?
Well, like something frivolous or something important?
Both.
Either, both.
All right, frivolous, I'd be 40. And
like
important, I would make Donald Trump still doing some sort of busy work in New York.
Have you met him?
I don't think I was introduced to him, but I saw him at a party. It wasn't like I was running up to meet him either.
How important do you think it is, actually, for people with a platform, for people with celebrity, to actually make a political stand at this time in the world's history?
The thing I think is that just because you're famous or because you've done something that gives you some notoriety, it doesn't mean that you've given up your citizenship. So I see him as maybe the most dangerous person in my country, so I can't not voice my dismay and my fear and my anger. And, I mean, he's ruining my country.
And you're making ours better, though, by being here. Oh, Cher, thank you. Just made my night.
Thank you. So important. Thank you.
Cher, thank you so much. It's an honour.
Pleasure. Thank you. Love to meet you. Thank you.
Of course, today's Mardi Gras would not be possible were it not for the brave actions of those who took part in the 1978 Mardi Gras, or the 78ers. I spoke to one of the 78ers, Betty Hounslow, at the Mardi Gras press conference last week.
Well, you must remember that 78ers are people who were involved in the march on the night of the 24th of June 1978, as well as people who were involved in the demonstrations afterwards, because it didn't finish then. So I wasn't there on the night at King's Cross when the police rioted and attacked us, but I was there just after that when we went to the police station where people had been held. And I was involved in the protests that came afterwards and was arrested in one of those protests. But that night, everybody knows about in the gay community who of a certain age in Australia. It was a frightening night when the police absolutely rioted and were brutal in their attacks on people.
Looking back over the last 40 years, what changes have you seen in the Mardi Gras?
I think that the original Mardi Gras were very political. We were still fighting big battles in terms of decriminalisation of male homosexuality, in terms of the Police Summary Offences Act, which was used to pick up people for nothing and throw them in the lockhouse. There was a political edge to the Mardi Gras, which I think was lost at certain points. I think it has come back now. I think that there's been a bit of a turning of the circle. And so the Mardi Gras now is a wonderful parade, a wonderful spectacle, but it also makes some hard-hitting political points. And I think that I'm pleased that it's called this year a parade of love and protest.
And, of course, we've had marriage equality in the last year here in Australia, I guess, which is a big political win for the LGBT community.
It is a big political win, and it's wonderful that those who want to get married now can get married. And at the same time, we want to make sure that those who want to live a different type of lifestyle are not marginalised in our community. We don't want to get back to a situation where there were good gays and bad gays, which there was in the past, and it would be a pity now if only those in monogamous committed marriage relationships were seen as being acceptable gays and lesbians, because our community is very, very diverse, and that's our strength, and we want to keep it.
The New South Wales Police Force has radically changed its attitude towards the LGBTIQ community since 1978, and they now have over 200 gay and lesbian liaison officers in New South Wales.
So I'm Assistant Commissioner Tony Crandell. I'm the New South Wales Police Force Corporate Spokesperson for Sexuality, Gender Diversity and Intersex. This year I'm also the Commander of the Police Response to Mardi Gras 2018, and our police will be on a safety mission to make sure that people are safe and that the footprint is secure for a very successful Mardi Gras event. We acknowledge that it is the 40th year of since the start of Mardi Gras, and that the 78ers were heavily involved in that particular celebration, which was termed as a protest. But it's important to understand the history, and it's important to understand where the police have gone wrong in the past. There was an apology that I issued on behalf of the New South Wales Police Force on the 4th of March 2016, and we reiterate that position today to the 78ers. We understand that we didn't get things right, and we apologise for the pain and hurt that we caused the 78ers back then. The positive part is that police have participated in the Mardi Gras parade for the last 22 years. We've marched for the last 20 of those years, and we are in a very, very good place in terms of our relationship with the LGBTI community, as well as our partners, the AIDS Council of New South Wales, City of Sydney, all of the people that put Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras together, including the organising committee. We have a fantastic relationship with them. We value that relationship. We have a memorandum of understanding that outlines our cooperation in that respect, and it certainly paid dividends in relation to the way that we police the parade and the things that we achieve together as a team. I think that that our participation in the parade is so important. It bridges a lot of gaps. It makes sure that we never return to a position that we were in 1978. We make sure that we work with the community, that we're there for the safety of the community, and that we're not there to use tactics that are inappropriate or that cause any pain, hurt, or otherwise interfere with the comfort of people that are actually at an event to celebrate and have a good time.
And for the size of Mardi Gras, for the size of the number of people attending, they really are fairly well behaved, aren't they?
Oh, my word. Mardi Gras is one of our favourite events because people are in such a good mood. People are there to celebrate. The amount of people that say Happy Mardi Gras to me, it's an international audience. It's not just about Australia. And we're on the international stage. And the way I see our policing response is that we need to respond with the type of policing that our LGBTIQ community understand and appreciate. We need to be firmly of the view that we're on a safety mission and that every police officer is there to assist.
For This Way Out, this is Barry Mackay wishing you a happy Mardi Gras from Sydney, Australia.
The Mardi Gras parade crowds were indeed well-behaved. Only 5 arrests were reported, most for alcohol-fueled disorderly conduct. Barry's report also mentioned that Cher was watching the parade with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. But there was more going on behind the scenes. The Twitterverse exploded when Turnbull posted a selfie with Cher along with his Mardi Gras greetings. Fans were quick to fill in the foreign pop dignitary on the PM's role in forcing the marriage equality plebiscite that had allowed for so much anti-queer hate mongering. They also pointed to his stance against refugees, as well as his complicity in potential new attacks on queer rights. Cher issued an apology the following day, tweeting, "I am so sorry. Guess that's why I have few friends who are politicians." She was generally forgiven for not being up on Australian politics. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Carol Myers and Wenzel Jones, with thanks to Steve Pride and Barry McKay. Cher performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com. Or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lisa Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WBSU, Brockport, New York, KZSC, Santa Cruz, California, 2MIA, Griffith, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station, where our big birthday bash is coming soon. So stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 1968 was huge. So many things happened in so many countries and in the context of so many social and political pressures and formations that to speak of 1968 as a unitary phenomenon is a kind of artifice. It serves as a kind of stand-in for a world historical protest moment that, even 50 years later, is being reassessed and reexamined. And then, of course, 1968 occurred in the context of the tumultuous years that preceded and followed it, which is why many people use the term 1968 in quotes or refer to the global 1960s or the long 60s. Still, there are some ideas and principles that united the various upheavals of 68, and it's definitely worth pondering their legacy and how they might inform or inspire struggles for social and economic justice in the current moment. Timothy Scott Brown has thought deeply about these and related issues. He is professor of history at Northeastern University, and his books include West Germany and the Global 60s, The Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978, and The Global 60s in Sound and Vision, Media, Counterculture, Revolt. His book 60s Europe is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. When Timothy Scott Brown joined me recently in studio, I began by asking him, since 60s radicals are often referred to as the new left, to describe the old left.
The old left is obviously a term that one doesn't start using until there's a new left, right? And so the old left, from the perspective of the new left, is that left that is centered in the classical communist and socialist parties. The socialist parties of the 19th century and especially the communist parties of the 20th century that is connected with a set of concerns having to do with, obviously, class is central and the class struggle is central to the thinking of these parties. And the social basis of these parties is the working class, which predominantly means the industrial proletariat, which has the connotation of male factory workers. So the new left, in a way, in some of the ways it reacts against this, is it starts to privilege things that were left out of the equation of the old left. So if the old left is about workers in factories and it's about the class struggle, then the new left can be, you know, seen as trying to expand who the representatives of the revolution are, trying to open up new issues having to do with, you know, daily life and sexuality and all sorts of other things that weren't so much the centerpiece of old left politics.
What were the principal accomplishments of the old left?
Well, the principal accomplishments of the old left were to respond to the situation of immiseration of the working class that was created by the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, Marxism and various other types of socialist thought, and the socialist parties that spring up in the First International and also anarchism are all responses to a situation that, you know, wasn't created by the people who were impacted by it. It was created by, you know, larger forces, and namely the Industrial Revolution, the rise of capitalism. So the old left took as its responsibility coming up with an analysis of the situation of workers in a, you know, modernizing industrial economy under capitalism, and did things like organize workers in the International or various sort of working men and women's organizations, in some cases in organizing typically with, you know, the sort of followers of Mikhail Bakunin and people like that, organizing sort of insurrections or insurrectionary secret societies, but also the creation of trade unions and basically the establishment of certain basic rights that we now take for granted, right, but sort of form the necessary basis for there to be something that we would refer to as a new left.
And we're going to jump ahead. I mean, we're going to obviously leave so much behind, but maybe we'll fill out the historical picture as we go along. So in the 1950s and 60s, what happens to the landscape of revolutionary actors and agitators? Who joined their ranks? Who constituted their ranks?
Well, in the immediate post-World War II period, you have this sort of anti-fascist consensus, but it evaporates very quickly. I mean, there's these sort of national fronts, you know, in the various countries in Europe in which anti-fascists of different stripes get together and fight what is the obvious evil of Italian fascism and German Nazism. Relatively quickly, this sort of, you know, emancipatory unity gets sabotaged by the Cold War as early as 1947 or so, right? So there's this moment of post-war possibility that quite quickly gets into this situation of this Cold War deep freeze and all that means in terms of the two superpowers clamping down on movements in countries, you know, obviously in the Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and also in the American sphere of influence in Greece and countries like that. There's, of course, the persistence of fascism in Spain, but also of fascist personnel and structures of thought in former fascist countries like Italy and Germany. And really, in the 1950s and 60s, there's the rise of a number of new groups across Europe and, of course, in the United States as well, who don't see themselves as being able to fit into the mold of the old left anymore. I mean, one primary reason for this is Stalinism, right? And even though Western communist parties, especially the French Communist Party, really refuse to break with Stalinism, I mean, that's a variegated picture across Europe. Some are more Stalinized than others. But they have massive support and they have an electoral presence, but the issues that they are talking about or interested in and the compromises that they have to make in terms of, you know, pretending that Stalinism is okay or that the Soviet Union is basically good is something that a lot of people can't swallow, right? And the big moment that comes when people can't swallow it is obviously 1956 when the Hungarian uprising happens. And there's attempts to form, you know, workers' councils and create some kind of new, freer version of socialism, and that's crushed by the Soviet Union. And so many intellectuals and just regular people in the West realize that communism, that Stalinized communism is a non-starter now, and that it basically isn't something that one can sign on to. So there's a bunch of different sources for something to replace this reliance on communist parties. So one of them is in youth culture, which really is something that starts in its modern form in the, maybe in the late 40s and in the 1950s. This is sort of the culture of juvenile delinquency and rock music, which was called beat music in Europe at this time. And the idea of youth as this autonomous social force that has insurrectionary potential, even if it's not explicitly political, but it could be made political, right? So there are certain people who want to mobilize youth radicalism, juvenile delinquency as a political tool. And a main group there are the Provos in Amsterdam, which we could talk more about at length if you want. But so that's one wing of this. Another comes out of the avant-garde in the arts, especially, you know, these sort of tendencies in France, for example, with the Lettrist or the Situationist International to find a place where art can be rejuvenated in the service of revolutionary projects so that art should no longer be something that's confined to the museum, but art should be a way of unsettling existing social relations and should have an explicit tie-in with different types of revolutionary politics. And one of the key things that comes out of the interventions of the Lettrist and the Situationist and people like that is the development of the art prank as a means of political struggle, right? So there's the famous one that Grail Marcus and other people have written about where the Lettrists go in Notre Dame Cathedral at Easter Mass and kidnap the priest and tie him up and put on his robes and then give a sermon wearing the priest's robes proclaiming the death of God. Mm. And then they, when they're discovered, they're chased out to the banks of the Seine and set upon by an angry mob of Christians and they have to be rescued by the police. And there's a group in London, King Mob, who were operating out of this tradition later in the 60s, and they did another classic prank, which was to go into Selfridge's department store dressed as Santa Claus and give presents off the shelves to the children. So the store had to call the police and have Santa arrested, right? So these are ways in situationist parlance of creating the situation that reveals the underlying social relations behind daily life, right? So like, you know, in the case of Notre Dame, they're celebrating the love of Christ, but yet they want to kill the people who disrupted the service. And then in the case of the King Mob prank, they're exposed the real existing economic relationships underneath property, right? So even though the kids are getting presents from Santa. So this sort of avant-garde art tradition and these pranks become really important in France and West Germany and the UK and the United States as a way of doing a new kind of politics that has very little obvious connection to the old left.
So you have these avant-garde artists and provocateurs. You have the youth culture, the burgeoning youth culture with the associated music subcultures, the emergence of rock and roll. What other participants and agitators were part of this new left constellation?
So another important piece of this puzzle are students. And in the 60s, the student populations are massively expanding. And in many cases, they face authoritarian structures in the university, you know, professors just giving these lectures in this very top-down fashion, no participation, you know, sort of poor infrastructure or sort of alienating university campuses and a feeling of lack of participation, a feeling that they're being groomed to, you know, just be cogs in this consumer capitalist machine, right? Which also has a component of imperialism and militarism to it as well. So students are very important. There's talk in the 60s of students, you know, making up a so-called new class, right? Like a class that can become a revolutionary subject in its own right as opposed to the industrial proletariat. And the problem with the industrial proletariat from the perspective of 60s radicals is that we can say in a general way it's no longer revolutionary or it's been bought off by capitalism. People are getting television sets and automobiles and things like that, and so they are less likely to rebel. It's actually not completely true that the working class wasn't able to rebel, though. I mean, obviously in May 68 in Paris, it turned into the biggest wildcat strike in history. Working class militancy is very strong in Italy, for example. So in some countries, the working class is relatively quiescent, like West Germany, the UK, and some countries it's quite radical, like in Italy and to an extent in France.
Timothy Scott Brown joins us in studio. He is professor of history at Northeastern University. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. And he joins us to talk about the global revolt of 1968. And I put that in quotes, and we'll talk with Tim about why he puts it in quotes and the continuing relevance of those events today. So what you're telling me then is the new left, the 60s radicals, they didn't see the working class as having the revolutionary potential or playing the revolutionary role that the old left did. So where does the new left look to, or who does the new left look to for filling this role, for occupying this role of revolutionary agent?
Well, the new left looks to, you know, new groups of actors like university students and artistic political avant-gardes and youth culture, and they also look especially to the revolutionaries of the Third World, because during the time of the student movements in the West, this is a period in which, you know, in France, for example, in the 50s, they were fighting the war in Algeria and the war in Vietnam, and then the U.S. inherited the war in Vietnam. There are struggles in Latin America and Africa. It's a period of worldwide anti-colonial revolt. And so a student in Europe could look at Castro or Che or even Mao and think that these are the people who are actually fighting the revolution, because they're the people who are fighting the great hegemon of the United States. So that's one reason why the Third World looms so largely in the imagination of Western radicals in the 1960s.
Let's talk about some of the events of 68. Remind us what happened in France in May of that year.
Sure. Well, in France, there was a campus outside Paris in Nanterre where students who were influenced by Situationism started instigating various, you know, sort of conflicts at the university in terms of disrupting the authoritarian structures, what they saw as the authoritarian structures of the university. And it spirals into this conflict with the authorities, in which students end up taking over, you know, occupying buildings, you know, these sort of standard practices of the international student movement in the 60s, and then get put on trial. So there's always this dynamic of students being arrested and then the campaigns around their arrest. And so this is mishandled by the authorities, and it spirals into a sort of urban insurrection, which is driven partly or primarily, I would say, by the police overreaction. They call them the riot police, and they attack students and passerby and create a situation in which, you know, students see sort of the naked hand of oppression, as it were, right, under the police truncheons. And then they start to try to make contacts with the workers. The workers, driven in part by their own concerns, start doing wildcat strikes. And there's this whole sort of anti-authoritarian uprising from below, where workers revolt against the advice of union heads. They all revolt against the advice of the Communist Party. The French Communist Party does its best to stop this, because the Communist Party has its own sort of position in French society that it wants to maintain. And it basically turns into a situation in which 20 million workers are on strike and the universities are in upheaval. And it vanishes relatively quickly, but it stuck very strongly in the radical imagination. It was influential at the time and has retained this sort of legendary status since then, in part, I think, because France is the seat of the modern revolution, right? And this sort of images of barricades in the Latin Quarter are very redolent of, you know, the French Revolution of 1789 and other French revolutions, the Paris Commune and so on. But also because it revealed the unwillingness to go along with business as usual that was lying right underneath the surfaces of daily life. And also, obviously, because of the poetic slogans of May 68 in Paris, like all power to the imagination and things like that.
The context of those uprisings was capitalism, a capitalist state. Another key event in 1968, and there were so many of them, was the Prague Spring. Remind us what happened there, and what is the significance to you of the fact that that occurred in the context of a nominally socialist state?
So in the Prague Spring, there were tendencies toward reform developing within the Czech Communist Party. Czechoslovakia had had fairly strong communist tradition compared to some of its Eastern European neighbors, but it also suffered more strongly under Stalinism than some of those and was actually relatively late to de-Stalinize. But when these reform tendencies started to develop, they kind of spiraled from the perspective of the Stalinist authorities out of control, and there was this idea of socialism with a human face. And when the Communist Party published its action program that involved things like creating freedom of the press or, you know, some liberalization of the press into censorship and things like that, the sort of birth of this nascent civil society that can't exist under Stalinism, right? And so ultimately the Soviet Union decided that it couldn't allow this to happen, so they invaded Czechoslovakia in August 1968 and put an end to this experiment. But the significance of it from the perspective of it taking place in a communist country for me is that it actually shows that there were alternative visions of socialism that were crushed by Soviet communism that were still there and could still break out in different ways. I mean, you can talk about the question of whether the Prague Spring is a revolutionary moment because you could say, well, as many scholars do, well, they're seeking reform within the communist system, but I look at it slightly differently, that they're actually trying to realize aspects of socialism that were suppressed by the communist system, right? They take as their starting point the idea that socialism isn't socialism if there's not freedom of the press, if there aren't freedoms of assembly. And so since 1989 and the fall of communism, one tendency has been to say, look, you know, they wanted what, you know, we refer to as the bourgeois freedoms, right, of freedom of speech, assembly, and all that. And now they got it because in 1989, the communism fell. But this isn't really what they were after at the time. Even if many of the protagonists became very, you know, sort of like disillusioned with any sort of socialist project later, which when one can't blame them, at that time, it was really an idea of a legitimate alternative version of socialism, a non-Bolshevik kind of socialism.
Timothy Scott Brown is his name. He teaches history at Northeastern University. His books include West Germany and the Global 60s, the Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978. And he co-edited the volume The Global 60s in Sound and Vision, Media, Counterculture, Revolt. His book 60s Europe is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what sets of ideas or principles, in your mind, unite the various uprisings of 1968 against different kinds of regimes, in different contexts, under different pressures? What could we say might be the core impulse of 68?
So what these movements have in common is an anti-authoritarianism that can arrange itself against different systems. So in the East, for example, in Czechoslovakia or Poland, this anti-authoritarianism can be aimed against the Bolshevik tradition as it's been passed down through Stalinism and the idea that socialism has to be a system in which no one has freedom to say anything or think or assemble or do anything outside the guidance of the Communist Party. In Western Europe, authoritarianism can be seen in the university or in the workplace or in more general terms in the idea that society is organized around consumption and grooming students to take their place as cogs in the capitalist machine and then do their civic duty by purchasing the goods produced by capitalism. So anti-authoritarianism really is a underlying root principle that works in all these situations. And another underlying root principle that works in all these situations is the idea that all struggles are connected. That means that, you know, students and other radicals in both East and West see themselves as part of a global struggle, and not just because they see themselves in the context of the Third World Liberation movements, but because they know what's going on in the other countries. They know what's going on the other side of the Cold War divide across the Iron Curtain. And they see that other people are fighting for the same things that they're fighting for.
You've described 1968 as a convergence followed by a divergence. What was the convergence?
The convergence is the convergence of various aspects of civil society in the West, like trade unions, church groups, the peace movement, with the rising student intelligentsia that's rooted in an increase in students who are at university, along with, you know, youth culture, along with avant-garde artistic groups. I speak in terms of a convergence because of the sort of amorphousness of the idea of 1968. I mean, often in daily parlance, we talk about 1968 as you know, the crisis year where, you know, there was the Tet Offensive and, you know, the twin assassinations in the United States, or May 68 in Paris, or the crushing of the Prague Spring. But when scholars talk about 1968, we're referring to this kind of historical moment that starts maybe sometime in the late 1950s and goes into the 1970s. I mean, in my book in West Germany, I start in 62 and end in 78, right? So it kind of brackets the year 1968. So when I think in terms of a convergence, I'm thinking about the way that this historical moment begins and what sort of groups and concepts have to come together for us to start speaking of something that we can call 1968, or in the West German case, you know, the West German episode in this global 1960s or global 1968. And very clearly, in the year 68, in the West German case and the French case and a number of other cases, you see a divergence that I would say is even more clear than the convergence, right? The divergence is when groups, so let's say, take the West German example, two of the big campaigns in West Germany have to do with preventing the passing of these so-called emergency laws that allow the government to suspend civil liberties in the case of social unrest. That's one. The other has to do with the press monopoly, the Springer Press in West Germany, which is kind of like, I suppose, is kind of like the Rupert Murdoch of West Germany, if you want to look at it like that, right? So when these two campaigns fail in the second half of 1968, when they don't, you know, they have this campaign to expropriate Springer, right? And obviously, you know, that's a huge goal, and that doesn't happen. And they also fail to stop the emergency laws from being passed. And from this point on, there's a decision that has to be made about, you know, how can we continue our radicalism? What sort of avenues can we put our radicalism into? And connected to that is the question of who we need to be working with to do this. So, for example, for university students or countercultural radicals, especially for the university students, I think there's this idea that we students can't do this alone, right? So we either need to connect with the working class in a more or less classical Marxist fashion, or we need to do one of a number of other possible actions. So one of these can be to form neighborhood sort of action groups that can connect with local struggles and schools and factories. Another might be to form urban insurrectionary cells, which might be sort of like living the revolution at the level of daily life in communes, or could even bleed over into actual what they called quote-unquote armed struggle, i.e. terrorism, left-wing terrorism. It could involve, you know, going back to the lands, kind of like in America, the idea of, you know, the hippie counterculture and seeking out new vistas of, you know, personal liberation, collective liberation by escaping capitalism in the cities and getting out to the country and rebuilding their life anew, right? And then most important, or one of the most important and remarked upon directions in this divergence, is the rise of second wave feminism and the women's movement, which really gets started at the end of the 60s and develops in the 1970s. And then there's also the green movement, which, you know, at the end of my West Germany book ends in 78 with the so-called Tunics Congress in West Berlin. And that's when the Greens get born. And that's another important aspect of this divergence.
So a significant strand of the New Left was Marxist, still believed in the potential of Marxist ideas. Now, for those who opposed authoritarian regimes, authoritarian nominally communist regimes, how was Marxism thought of? Because on the one hand, it could be seen as an ideological pretext for this one-party rule. But on the other hand, it could be viewed as a set of ideas that could lead the way, I guess, if properly cultivated and implemented, could lead the way toward an emancipatory future.
Right. Well, there's a strong attempt within the student intelligentsia on both sides of the Iron Curtain to retrieve the original good Marx that's been corrupted by Marxism-Leninism. I mean, Marxism-Leninism is really a body of thought and practice that's codified by Stalin, in the period after Lenin's death. And there's a strong recognition that, you know, one could, for example, turn to Marx's early writings and Alienation, for example, that one could really go back into the classics and find what's valuable. So, for example, in West Germany, Rudi Dutschke, the main student leader, puts a lot of stock in this idea of we have to retrieve, you know, the original good Marx. And he makes contacts with an older generation of Marxist intellectuals like Ernst Bloch as part of this project. Later, one of the groups that I didn't mention in the Divergence I did sort of mention them because there's this idea of going back to the working class, but this idea spawns the creation of all these little parties in Germany. In West Germany, they were called the K group and or the communist groups, who call themselves Marxist, Leninist, or Maoist groups and have the explicit goal of connecting with the industrial working class in a way that the student movement wasn't able to do. And this is connected to the idea that the basic project of Lenin and the project represented by Trotsky is a good project. So they could set themselves against Stalinism while retaining Bolshevism. And there's a strong counter movement within 68 to also reject Leninism and Trotskyism. And obviously this is a project that anarchists are involved in. It's a project that, you know, the Situationist International is involved in. They take a dim view toward, you know, Marxism-Leninism, and they also actually take a dim view toward the third world struggles, third world liberation struggles, which they see as a phenomenon that's held up by student radicals as an unequivocal good, when the actual politics of, you know, radicals in Vietnam or Cuba or whatever don't actually withstand a lot of close analysis. So this was the argument, and they proved correct.
His name is Timothy Scott Brown. He's professor of history at Northeastern University. We'll take a short break and speak more with him about the global revolt of 68, understood to extend far beyond the year 1968. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. My guest, Timothy Scott Brown, teaches history at Northeastern University. He's the author of Weimar Radicals, Nazis and Communists Between Authenticity and Performance, and West Germany and the Global 60s, the Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978. And his book, 60s Europe, is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. Let's talk more about the anarchist strand of the New Left. How do you define anarchism, and what happened to people's interest in anarchism in the 60s?
So in the 60s, there are still surviving elements of interwar anarchism, and there's kind of especially a Spanish anarchist diaspora that sends former militants of the CNT FAI from Spain, you know, who had to leave Spain after the collapse of the Republic in the Civil War, and who take up residence in the UK, in France, in West Germany, in various places. So the idea of the Spanish Revolution and, you know, the anarchist militancy that saw workers seize control of factories in Barcelona and Catalonia and so forth exerts a real powerful pull in the radical imagination in 1968. But the anarchism that actually sort of grows up organically among young people doesn't have so much in common with this older guard of anarchist who, you know, who in their own way are a little bit old left, right? You know, industrial militants, right? And the new anarchism is more, tends to be more youth countercultural anarchism, but it's an anarchism. So in the case of the provos in Amsterdam, I mean, they know, you know, interwar militants. Like they engage in this, what I see is one of the key 68 projects, which is going back into the past and finding useful source material for use in the present, right? So one way of going back into the past is to actually make contact with militants of previous generations who are still around. And the Marxist intellectuals do that by trying to connect with Lukács and Ernst Bloch, for example. And on the anarchist side of things, the young militants also know, you know, the provosts, for example, were influenced by people that they knew from interwar Dutch anarchist groups. And there's a famous case in which a young Scottish anarchist, Stuart Christie, who knew people who were in the exile Spanish organizations, became involved in a plot to assassinate Franco. And he actually went to Spain and tried to assassinate Franco and was put in prison and somehow survived. And he's written a book called Granny Made Me an Anarchist, where he talks about the plot, his role in the plot to kill Franco. Anyway, anarchism is there in the presence of former radicals from Spain and elsewhere. Anarchism is there as a sort of commitment to turn youth revolt and juvenile delinquency into in revolutionary directions. Right? I mean, there's this idea in anarchism, for example, traditionally, that the revolutionary actor doesn't just have to be an industrial factory worker. It can be social outgroups, right? This is present even in the idea of Herbert Marcuse, who's really influential for student radicals in the 60s, the idea that maybe the revolution isn't going to come from the working class anymore. Maybe it's going to come from outgroups, from third world radicals, from juvenile delinquents, from various kinds of nonconformist actors. So anarchism informs the efforts of, for example, the provos or the Kommune Eins in West Germany and groups like that, informs their efforts to come up with a new sort of political praxis that is based on new actors, right? That doesn't, because if the working class isn't revolutionary, we have to look elsewhere. Also, the core concept of anarchism is that people do self-organization, self-management. So sometimes there are people active in the 60s who see themselves explicitly as anarchists. But in other cases, they're pursuing a basically anarchist line, whether they call themselves anarchist or not, right? So if they focus, for example, on self-management, on workers' control of factories, or the right of citizens to control a neighborhood district or an apartment building or to squat an apartment building, all these ideas and practices are kind of bound up with these ideas of anti-authoritarian self-management. And this is really important in the 60s. And it's one reason why communist parties and sort of 68-type radicals don't always get along very well in the 60s.
Since none of the revolutionary formations of the new left actually seized power, and since culture was so important to the new left, as you've been saying, the youth culture, art, publishing, new ideas being circulated, can we then say that a kind of cultural revolution was effected by 60s radicals as opposed to a political revolution that may not have been realized or accomplished or implemented?
Well, we can certainly say that there wasn't a political revolution in the sense of an overturning of existing social and political relations. We can also say that there was a cultural revolution, although that term has been used in a number of different iterations that have kind of a different political valence. So, for example, one often talks about the cultural revolution of the 1960s in the sense meant by someone like the British historian Arthur Marwick, who really focuses almost solely on changes at the level of daily life and the way people think about their lives and possibilities of consumption and changing mores in the realm of the family and sexuality and all that kind of stuff, and downplays very much the attempts of radicals to make any sort of more thoroughgoing change to social and political relations. And some scholars have talked about cultural revolution in what I see as a more nuanced way, in terms of seeing how political ideas were articulated through cultural practices, right? Like at the level of daily life, or through consumption, or through artistic production and things like that. And you have certain former radicals. One thinks, for example, of Daniel Clemendit, who was the student leader in May 68, who...
In France.
In France, who came along later and said, well, you know, we won the Cultural Revolution because we changed not just, you know, issues of daily life and consumption, but we created a freer culture. But it's a good thing that our political ideals of syndicalism or anarchism didn't get put into place, because it would have been disastrous. So, you know, this is the purported wisdom of hindsight. And certainly people as they age are prone to, and certainly have the right to, have a critique of their youthful radicalism. I'm a little bit skeptical about placing too much attention on the utterances of former radicals, which might seem funny in a way, because you would think that they would be the repository of knowledge. And on one level, they are the repository of knowledge. But on another level, I consider paying too much attention to what they say. I refer to this as the veteran fallacy, right? The idea that the veteran acquires but then retains for however many more decades they live the right to adjudicate disputes about the events in question.
I see.
Their mind changes about what they did. But as we study the historical moments, what concerns me and what I'm interested in is what they thought then, not what they think when they're old later.
Gotcha.
Right.
I'm joined in studio by Timothy Scott Brown. He is a professor of history at Northeastern University. His forthcoming book is called 60s Europe. And his new book project is titled The Greening of Cold War Germany, Environmentalism and Social Movements Across the Wall and Beyond, 1968 to 1989. And we're talking about 1968 in the broad sense. Some people call it the global 1960s. Some people call it the long 1960s. But certainly 1968, that tumultuous year, concentrated a lot of activism and ferment. So we've talked a lot about 68, and there's so much more to be said. I wonder if you could sort of try and sum up what you see as the meaning of 1968. What do we need to keep in mind about kind of the essential messages and stances of 68?
Well, I think one of the things that's important about 1968 is that, I mean, in historical terms, it challenged the Cold War. It weighed in on behalf of decolonization. So it took up a bunch of positions that have aged very well, in terms of opposition to Soviet communism that was simultaneously opposition to, you know, U.S. imperialism, the war in Vietnam, and so on and so forth. It tried and in part succeeded to break down authoritarian structures in society. And 1968 is important as one of the last moments in which there was a challenge, a thoroughgoing challenge to capitalism as it exists now. It was obviously, it was a challenge to communism as well, but communism is no longer with us. In the period after 1989, there was talk of the end of history, that, you know, Western democracy and consumer capitalism were the sort of endpoint. And I think it's pretty clear at this point that that's kind of a flawed concept. But I think 68 showed that it was possible to dispute conditions that are very similar to our current conditions. And I guess what's interesting is how in the 50 years since 1968, it's become really difficult to imagine alternatives to capitalism. I mean, who's the famous quote by that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism?
Jameson?
I think it's Jameson.
Frederick Jameson. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Jameson. We can look it up, though, anyway. But and I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And I think 1968 retains a place in the imagination, and in particular in the radical imagination, because it's a moment not so long ago when it was possible to imagine an alternative to capitalism. 1968 is also, of course, the source of some of the strands of emancipatory practice that are still with us. For example, the rise of what we refer to now as identity politics, of feminisms, of gay rights movements and so on and so forth. So in some ways, some aspects of the sort of late 68 critique that becomes really prominent in the 1970s have become received wisdom in a good way. And some of the other critiques that have to do with the role of class or the question of whether capitalism is a sensible system for the organization of human societies have received less attention. But these questions were put very strongly on the table in 1968, and I think that's one reason for its enduring relevance.
How important is it to you that the New Left wasn't driven so much by materialist concerns, by concerns about having enough to eat and meeting other basic needs?
What's important about that to me is how much it's not the case now. That's what really appears strongly to me from the vantage point of 50 years out. So in the 60s, there was a basic assumption that issues of material plenty had been solved in the West, right? Like, obviously, that wasn't the case in the Third World, but I mean, it was possible, for example, for the situationists to think that one of the key sort of revolutionary problems was the problem of boredom, that we need to learn to live authentically, live without dead time. But it's like now, under neoliberalism, we live in a situation in which those things aren't taken for granted anymore at all. So what's striking about 68 is how much there was this historical moment in the 1950s and the 1960s when, on some level, capitalism had produced some plenty and created a situation for certain citizens to think that survival wasn't the problem. So then you could turn to a higher order of concerns, which might have to do with fulfillment, for example, or might have to do with some sort of, you know, intellectual, spiritual progress. But it wasn't just simply bound up with those sorts of things, though, because there was always an eye on poverty, for example, in the United States. I mean, the 60s movement really comes out of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King's activism for the poor, and so on and so forth. So there was always a critique of want, misery, war, imperialism. That was very strong in the 60s, but that coexisted with the rise of a post-materialist society that allowed people to strive for higher order goals. And it's a sad reflection of our current time that we no longer consider ourselves in a post-materialist situation.
And, you know, many of the students, for example, in the U.S., with Students for a Democratic Society, many of them were kind of accused of being spoiled kids, right? That they were from reasonably well-off or very well-off families. And so, you know, who were these revolutionaries and how authentic could they be given their class position in society?
Well, I think that argument rests on a debased deployment of the idea of social class. You know, I mean, Marxism didn't posit this monolithic working class against which everything else was going to be judged. If Marx had been around in the 1960s, he would have been on the side of student radicals because he would have seen that they were involved in the process of trying to produce large-scale social change that required not just the emancipation of people who worked in factories, but involved everyone's emancipation and not just their emancipation from want or physical needs, but their emancipation from the sort of, you know, psychic parameters that were passed down to them by the reigning social system, right? So obviously this idea of spoiled children or that students were spoiled and didn't have the right to their radicalism doesn't really hold a lot of water. I mean, this idea is an idea aimed at policing what's politically permissible for the young.
And what about the contradiction in the 60s between those who, and I think you alluded to it earlier, who wanted to kind of drop out of society, and we're speaking in significant part about the counterculture, as opposed to those who wanted to transform society? How important was that contradiction, and to what extent did it dilute what the New Left, what 60s radicals were able to do?
I see this contradiction as one that's inherent in any post-1945 radical movement and actually probably in earlier periods too, although less prominent there, obviously. But the idea that there's going to be a monolithic block of revolutionary actors, you know, doesn't stand up to a lot of scrutiny, right, in terms of the possibility of such a thing actually existing in the real world. Because as we know, people have widely varying views and perspectives. And I think that this is partly why I use this idea of convergence and divergence, because under convergence, it was possible to think that all these things went together. And in the period of divergence, things diverged, but they diverged because they were never part of the same thing to begin with. They're only provisionally part of the same thing in the sense that they were happening at the same time, and people could think in that moment that, yes, you know, the hippies are a radical force, you know, working class militants are a radical force. There's this idea that we're moving towards some kind of crisis moment or some sort of millennial moment in which all these energies are going to coalesce and overthrow the system. But when that doesn't happen, the fact that these things were always on parallel tracks becomes obvious. And that's really what the divergence is, right? It's the idea that all these things are part of some unitary moment, some 1968 moment, is revealed to be something that just people believed for a short period of time, but it wasn't actually the case. And it's a natural thing in, for example, in Western society, the idea of, I mean, it goes back into the 19th century and earlier in the transcendentalist and so on and so forth, the idea that there's some sort of higher reality that can be accessed, you know, in quietude or accessed in communion with one's fellow men and animals in a small group, that society on some level is corrupt or corrupting. This is a perennial position that one could take, right? And it comes out strongly in the late 60s and in the 70s and is one feature of this sort of millenarianism of the 60s and 70s. And there was always in the 60s a split in the United States. We talk of the movement and the counterculture, right? The movement is not the counterculture, but there was a strong feeling that the movement and the counterculture belonged together, and in some ways they did, and they cross-fertilized each other, that it was inevitable that these things would split off when people began facing the hard questions of, you know, they're not just trying to reform the system, but they're trying to revolutionize the system. It then becomes necessary to figure out how you're going to do that. So, for example, in the United States, you know, Students for a Democratic Society with the Port Huron statement, you know, they were interested in the twin issues of racism and the Cold War, and the movement very much becomes involved with the Vietnam War as the 60s go on. So it really becomes a movement oriented less towards solving America's problems of racism and, you know, poverty and things like that, or the broad sort of meta category of the Cold War and the threat of nuclear destruction, but it ends up being about this war and all the, you know, the destructive things that's connected with or come out of that. But basically what I was trying to say is that SDS has these set of concerns that have to do with just making a society that's basically okay better. And there's this idea in America that also exists in West Germany and some other countries that the country's basically right, but we need to make it better because it has these certain problems. And this is why I place a lot of emphasis on the role played by cognitive dissonance. And I argue that these movements really become radicalized when they realize that the claims of authority and the claims of the parent generation in the society actually don't bear up to any scrutiny, right? So in the United States, the students in SDS know that the country has a legacy of racism. They know that there are problems of poverty and that they know that the U.S. is involved in an arms race that could end humanity. But, you know, there's a reason why in the Port Huron statement they talk about the Constitution, right? Because they're basically like young, intelligent people who've bought into the American system. And what happens over the course of the 60s is that buy-in is shattered by police violence, by the war in Vietnam, by all sorts of actions of elites that allow people to no longer – that don't allow people any longer to think that the society is basically good. So there are these liminal moments, 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, you know, various 1968 events in the United States, like the assassinations of RFK and Martin Luther King, for example, or the war in Vietnam more generally. These things make it impossible to continue thinking that the country is basically okay. And this happens across societies, this moment of cognitive dissonance.
Timothy Scott Brown, he's professor of history at Northeastern University. Again, his books include West Germany and the Global 60s and the Global 60s in Sound and Vision, which he co-edited. His book 60s Europe is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. Thanks, Timothy, so much for joining me in studio and talking about your work.
Thanks for having me, C.S.
And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.